God damn it! My life has value!
I want you to get up now. I want all of you to get up out of your chairs. I want you to get up right now and go to the window, open it, and stick your head out and yell, I'm as mad as hell, and I'm not going to take this anymore! I want you to get up right now. Get up, go to your windows, open them, and stick your head out and yell, I'm as mad as hell, and I'm not going to take this anymore!
Listen, you fuckers, you screwheads. Here's a man who would not take it anymore. A man who stood up against the scum, the cunts, the dogs, the filth, the shit. Here is someone who stood up.
Hey, the British!
And good evening, everybody, and welcome to another edition of UF Tread on Me Radio. Tonight I'm going to be having Sleepy Salsa on with me, one of the other hosts who normally broadcasts on Saturdays. We're going to be discussing the difference between anarchism, libertarianism, and a republic form of government. So if you're listening over at TFN Truth Finders Network, sorry about the dead air. I normally do a short intro, which none of you got to hear. So that was a moment. That was a reason for about 40 seconds of dead air before I came on. Sorry about that. I'm still waiting to get the player and everything hooked up on my other page for TFN. Then I'll be able to broadcast solely or on my own, and you guys will hear the intro and everything there. A couple things. Where are we at? I've been rushed and hectic today. I just started a new job, and I've been going through training online and learning a new industry, even though everything is sales-related. I'm still doing new business development, but I'm developing new business for a completely different industry than what I'm used to working in, so lots of things to learn. So I've been kind of hectic and frazzled the last couple of days, lots of studying, even when I'm not in training. So I didn't get any show broadcasts out for tonight on any of the places I normally announce the broadcast at, so I apologize for that, but it is what it is. The book, Resistance to Tyranny, two places you can get it at, Amazon, and you can get it from me here at UF Tread on Me Radio. If you click on the link on the show page, there's a little blurb there, Resistance to Tyranny, picture of Joe Martino, an essential handbook for militias and committees of safety. Click on that, it'll take you to the buy page, to the page about the show, about the book description, and you can buy it there. Or at the very top of the website, you can go to the Resistance to Tyranny link. Real simple. The book is $17.95. And everybody that buys the next 20 copies is going to get a signed copy for free. Regular price on the signed copies are $24.95. But the first 20 people that buy a book here from me instead of Amazon, because Amazon does not need your money, support a patron instead of those big giants, they get a signed copy of his book for free with a little message from Joe Martino in each one. I haven't really been pushing the books lately. I've been trying to get these other things done. So there's my book blurb. Gratuitous consumerism, but consumerism for a good product. I truly believe that every militia member out there, every committee of safety, every militia member should have one. Every committee of safety should have several copies on hand. Hell, I believe every American should have one. This book is truly an A to Z primer on resisting tyranny, the who's, the what's, the where, the when, the why, and the how of it. Written by the counterinsurgency expert for the U.S. military for many, 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 many years. And also one of my favorite guests on here. We've done probably 8 or 9 different episodes with retired Colonel Joseph P. Martino. And I'll be getting all of his previous episodes nicely compiled all together on that same page as well, called Resistance to Tyranny, where you can look at the book at. Let's see, what else? Well, that's about it, you know. So, but what I'm going to do before we start is actually let's define some of these things we're going to be discussing tonight. Anarchism, libertarianism, a republic. But if we're going to define those, we also have to define classical liberalism. And since classical liberalism is a little bit older, well, no, I wouldn't say older. Well, actually, no, let's start with anarchism first. So we're going to start defining some of these subjects that we're going to be discussing tonight. And if you have any questions, you can pop them in the chat room. If you do me a favor, if you have a question, put the cap locks on so I know it's a question and not just a comment, because sometimes that chat room just gets scrolling really fast. I don't know what's a question for me and what's a general statement to the chat room or what. So if you got a question, either put it in cap locks or put, Randy, you got a question, and then, you know, call in the question or whatever it is. But let's start with anarchism. Anarchism is generally defined as a political philosophy which holds the state to be undesirable, unnecessary, and harmful, or alternatively, opposing authority and hierarchical organization in the conduct of human relations. Proponents of anarchism, known as anarchists, advocate stateless societies based on non-hierarchical voluntary associations. There are many types and traditions of anarchism, none of which are mutually exclusive. Anarchist school of thought can differ fundamentally, supporting anything from extreme individualism to complete collectivism. Strains of anarchists have been divided into categories of social and individualist anarchism, or dual classifications, or similar dual classifications. In other words, you know, anarchism is basically doing what everything else in this world does. You take a basic concept or idea, and then everybody takes what they like, and they form, you know, they treat it like a Chinese food buffet, just like the Bill of Rights and the Constitution. They take what they like and they leave the rest, and then they form their own little group or idea of thought process on it, even though it's all generally the exact same thing. One little minute, minuscule difference, and you got a whole new different sect of thinking. So that's anarchism. I'm not going to go into too much definition about that. The definitions really aren't important because we're going to actually get into the philosophical ideas here about it. So now on to libertarianism. Libertarianism is variously defined by sources. There is no consensus on the definition nor on how one should use the term as a historical category. There is general agreement that libertarianism refers to a group of political philosophies which emphasize freedom, individual liberty, and voluntary association. Libertarians generally advocate a society with little or no government power. The Standard Encyclopedia of Philosophy defines libertarian as a moral view that agents initially fully own themselves and have certain moral powers to acquire property rights and external things. Libertarian historian George Woodcock defines libertarianism as a philosophy that fundamentally doubts authority and advocates transforming society by reform or revolution. Libertarian philosopher Roderick Long defines libertarianism as any political position that advocates a radical redistribution of power from the coercive state to voluntary associations of free individuals, whether voluntary association takes the form of free markets or communal cooperatives. According to the U.S. Libertarian Party, libertarianism is the advocacy of a government that is funded voluntarily and limited to protecting individuals from coercion and violence. Libertarian is also going through the exact same thing that's going on with anarchism. You've got 10,000 different schools of thought on libertarianism. Everybody takes what they like, and if they have one little differing idea, they create a whole new different sect of libertarianism. So then you got all these people fighting with each other, or arguing with each other, or dissenting with each other about what libertarian is or what anarchism is within their own little groups, and they can't agree on anything either. We're not alone out there. Now, before we get to the Republic, I want to read something about classical liberalism. Classical liberalism is the philosophy committed to the ideal of limited government, constitutionalism, rule of law, due process, and liberty of individuals, including freedom of religion, speech, press, assembly, and free markets. You notice how liberalism and classical liberalism and libertarianism are pretty much the exact same thing. Classical liberalism developed in the 19th century in Europe and the United States, although classical liberalism built on ideas that had already developed by the end of the 18th century. It advocates a specific kind of society, government, and public policy as a response to the Industrial Revolution and urbanization. Some really famous classical liberalists out there were John Locke, Adam Smith. Thomas Jefferson was a classical libertarian, was a classical liberalist. In fact, most of the people out there who, you know, in the 18th century, who started talking about the rights of man, the rights of individuals, the right for us to be able to engage in free thought, free speech, the right to gather in assembly, These were all classical liberalists. So now, let us go to a republic. A republic is a form of government in which the government is officially appointed to the control of the people and thus a public matter, and where offices of state are subsequently directly or indirectly elected or appointed. In modern times, a common simplified definition of a republic is a government where the head of state is not a monarch. The word republic is derived from the Latin phrase res publica, which can be translated as the public affair and often used to describe a state using this form of government. Both modern and ancient republics vary widely in their ideology and composition. In classical and medieval times, the archetype of all republics was the Roman Republic, which referred to Rome in between the periods when it had kings and the period when it had emperors. The Italian medieval and Renaissance political traditions today, referred to as civic humanism, is sometimes considered to derive directly from Roman republics such as Sallust and Tacitus. However, Greek-influenced Roman authors such as Polybius and Cicero was an interesting man. He truly is what I would consider to be the first author, you know, who truly first wrote anything concerning the laws of nature, the laws of nature. Whereas man is free, man has the right to defend themselves by right of birth. No man is a slave. No man can be made a slave, against his free will, or no man has a right to be made a slave against his free will, or even with his free will. The very fact that we are able to think and hold tools and implements gives us the right to use those tools and implements to defend ourselves. You know, Cicero was an incredible man. This example goes on to say that this is an example of this is Sparta, which had two kings, but was not considered a normal hierarchy, as it also had ephors representing the common man. Now, if we look at Sparta, though, that's something I want to get into before we even jump off here. Everybody talks about Sparta, as being Sparta and Leonidas, especially with the whole movie 300 coming out. They talk about Sparta being an example of free men willing to stand up and keep their freedom. And that might be true there, but if we really look at Sparta, Plato himself said that Sparta was a perfect example of the perfect republic, in quotes. Plato's version of a republic. A republic where people thought they were free, but were truly the most enslaved people of all. In ancient Sparta, just like the movie said, your children were examined at birth, and if they were not deemed fit, they were killed. The state came and took your children at a very early age and indoctrinated them in all things state, whereupon they would never be able, after being done with this state education, they would have no concept of anything outside of what the state had taught them to think. Everybody had a role to play in the state. Military service was mandated. Those who were a little bit smarter than military service were given a little bit different role, ephors and things like that. But we must remember that the kings in ancient Sparta were not the power elite, if you will, nor was their Senate. It was the oracles of Delphi that were the elite there, the priest kings, as Plato called them. And the priest kings ruled. Their word was law. This was the ideal republic. And a place, according to Plato, and Plato's ideal republic was, again, a society, a civilization that, on the appearances, was ruled by the rule of law for the common man, of the common man, and by the common man. Yet the reality of it is that it was led by philosopher kings, priest kings, who then had their minions below them, who were the kings, and they took their orders from the priest kings. And below them was the intellectual elite, who did what they were told, who oversaw the military generals, who were a little bit smarter than the regular common footmen. And they did what they were told, and the foot soldiers did what they were told by their generals, and then we, the people, did what we were told by the society itself. That was Plato's version of republic, and that's how Sparta was actually run. Sparta, by no means, was a free society. It was Plato's version of, quote-unquote, the republic that he lays out in his book, The Perfect Society of Enslaved People. So with that being said, you now have the definitions for anarchism, libertarianism, classical liberalism, and a republic. And tonight our broadcast is going to be discussing, well, three, well, actually four. I mean, if you look at all of these concepts in and of themselves, they all delve from classical liberalism, even though anarchism, I guess, was older than all of them. But we'll be discussing all three or four of these concepts, no matter however you want to look at it, really delving into them. And luckily, you know, I was actually mentored by Ron Paul's mentor, a gentleman named Murray Rothbard. I got to know Murray Rothbard at UNLV. He became a professor there. He could only teach undergrads, even though he held PhDs, because he was a dangerous man with dangerous ideas, and he was not allowed to teach graduate-level students. So one of his friends, Hans Hoppe, who was also the founder of, you know, who was Murray Rothbard's right-hand man, he brought him over to UNLV in 1986, and when I was going to UNLV in 86, that was Murray Rothbard's first year. So I got to have both of the quote-unquote heads of the Libertarian Party as my professors. Now, Murray Rothbard was the founder of the Libertarian Party. I believe it was in the 60s, maybe very, 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 very early 70s. I think, in fact, he ran for president in 72. He was the head of the Libertarian Party. He was one of the founders of the Mises Institute. All these ideas stem from an individual named Ludwig von Mises, hence the name Mises Institute. These are all the ideas and philosophies that come from them. Lots of famous libertarians out there. Sleepy, go ahead and unmute. Are you there?
I'm here, Randy. How you doing this evening?
Good. Listen, what is that guy, man? He on Mises.org. He does a radio broadcast. Really famous guy. What the hell is his name?
Lou Rockwell, the founder of the Ludwig von Mises Institute. Lou Rockwell.
There we go. Lou Rockwell is the founder of the Mises Institute. You know, he was mentored by, in fact, you know, most of these people out there were either mentored by the people that were mentored by Murray Rothbard or Ludwig von Mises. You know, and when we really look at these, they're all very much saying the same thing, except similar slight differences. But tonight I'm going to expose, actually, this really heinous little fabrication and lie that the libertarians don't want anybody to realize. And I actually, at the ripe young age of 16, I actually pointed this out to Murray Rothbard myself during a class, and I kind of dumbstruck him. One of the few times I ever knew that meant not to have anything to say. But we're going to be getting into that now. So why don't we start off with this? Why don't we start off with anarchism? And since this is kind of more your realm here, Sleepy, why don't you go ahead and take anarchism for a little bit, and then I'll jump in whenever I, you know, have something, whenever I got 2 cents to throw at you or something.
Okay, thanks, Randy. I definitely appreciate it. All right, well, because of the content for this particular episode of YHTOM, just keep in mind for you guys, since a lot of you are constitutionalists, that when I use the phrase the state or a state or whatever, I'm not talking about like the state of Wyoming, Ohio, or anything like that. I mean the state with a capital S, which in libertarian parlance stands is interpreted to mean any form of government at any level or scope. So when I say the state this, the state that, I'm talking about any form of government at any point, you know, republic or monarchy or whatever the case is.
The state just represents the physical body of the government itself, if you will.
Right, right. I guess you could say the forceful arm of the body politic, if you want to put it that way. Because, I mean, that's what the state is. I mean, it's the social institution that maintains a monopoly on the use of coercive force. You know, generally speaking, the state is not thought of as something voluntary. Although, then again, I mean, we were always told that, you know, if we're going to have this thing called a republic, you know, it's consent by the governed, right? Consent. It's voluntary, right? You have a choice. Well, I mean, if that's true, then, you know, where's the consent? And even if you could answer that question in the affirmative, is there a way of revoking that consent? That's what I would like to know. you know, some people think that you can go through some sort of legal process or something to revoke your consent. But, you know, that aside, I think it's really important. This is like a key question. Is the state fundamentally, is it coercive or is it consensual or voluntary? And, you know, typical libertarian parlance will tell you that it's coercive. Well, if that's true, then consent of the governed cannot exist. So, because otherwise it would be a contradiction, right? That's kind of a really important thing to consider, as well as a lot of other things, you know, as we kind of go through the maze that is known as the grand field of political philosophy. But, you know, let's start with something that was kind of brought up on that one other thing I was listening to, which was, you know, there's this concept of, like, left libertarianism and right libertarianism. And, you know what, I know a lot of people kind of give a lot of credence to that, but I think that's a lot of baloney. The reason I say, with all due respect to Brad Moore, the reason I say that, and it's not just him, it's a lot of people, is because if the left-right paradigm is a true and accurate and objectively observable phenomenon, then there is no left-right anything at all. If it's all fake, a false dichotomy, which is what the left-right paradigm is, then there is no left libertarianism, there's no right libertarianism, it's just libertarianism, or libertarianism with various flavors. But there is no left, there is no right, and that's just silly. So I don't really see how that would even come into play.
Actually, no, let's actually define left and right, the left and right. You know, we use left and right today to represent liberals or conservatives,
right.
Republicans or Democrats, and that is not the true definition of left and right. The true definition of left and right when discussing political bodies is anarchism versus totalitarianism, anarchism being the extreme left, totalitarianism being the extreme right. Now, when our founding fathers created this government, they placed us in the middle between anarchism and totalitarianism. They placed us there for a reason. One, a complete lack of government does nobody any good. Too much government does nobody any good. So they placed us in the middle. Government to regulate some things, but the mandate of the people being first and foremost. So when we discuss left and right here, at least when I discuss left and right, I'm not talking about Democrats and Republicans or liberals and conservatives. When I talk about the left and the right, I'm talking about complete and utter lack of government, meaning anarchism, which does not mean chaos in the street, but a complete lack of government, versus totalitarianism. Now, in that sense, when you were discussing the left and right, you know, left and right libertarians, that's an interesting story, and I'm going to get into that a little bit later on when we're discussing libertarianism as a whole. But that was 2 cents I wanted to interject there, that left and right paradigm, because the left and right paradigm is a paradigm itself. It's been redefined to make you think of something else versus the truth of what left and right originally classically meant.
Right, exactly. And you see, it's kind of funny too, because there's also the assumptions of how you're using that measuring stick. You know, I remember seeing this old JBS documentary thing where they correctly stated what is essentially a left-right paradigm. And then they went to go on to describe what the real scale was, just like you did, where it's more an issue of how much power the state has. You know, is it a lot of power, little power, medium power, or something, you know, some other kind of qualification on state power. And that's accurate. But what was funny is that in that documentary, they had total government on the left side and then no government on the right side, and something they called the constitutional moderate position. So again, it's kind of like, okay, but it's a little bit of verbicide, actually, to really say left-right. What's better is to say, look, how much power does the state have? And if somebody can think of a nice scientific, you know, nice sounding way of putting it, but that's the thing. How much power does the state have? Is it a authoritarian, vertically integrated command and control power structure, or is it something that is more or less a guard that is so weak that it can't really do much of anything else except be a sentry, essentially. or does one not exist in the first place? I mean, that's kind of the issue, is how much power does the state have? And that's a really kind of critical question, because it's almost like, you know, a lot of people don't even think that way. And speaking also about a little bit of verbicide as well, you know, something that was kind of brought up in another broadcast was this notion of libertarian socialism. And, you know, I kind of like this. I mean, if you remember, Randy, when we did the homeschooling for dissidents episode, you know, I mentioned about like fallacious reasoning and stuff like that. Okay, cool. Well, here we have literally something that's a contradiction. You see, that's kind of the problem when you actually study like logic and rhetoric and whatever when you're young, is that you look at this stuff and it's like, I hate asparagus and I love it. It's like, do you like asparagus or not? Or maybe, or are you apathetic? That would be another option. No, I hate asparagus and I love it. Well, you know what? I think Orwell had a term for that. He called it doublethink. It's the same thing, though. It's a contradiction, and that's kind of the problem. Contradictions cannot logically exist. You know, it either has to be one premise or the other, or something else completely different. And what you need to do is check your premises and, you know, self-correct.
Do you mind if I interject a little bit on that and kind of expand upon that idea?
Yeah.
All right, there's a really famous author out there that many of you probably have heard of or know of or read even. His name is Noam Chomsky. Back in the 60s and 70s, he was a pretty famous professor. He's considered the father of linguistics, you know, the modern day father of linguistics at MIT. He writes a lot of books, you know, Manufactured Dissent, all kinds of stuff, you know, anti-government, you know, anti-corrupt government, anti-U.S. government stuff, you know, talks about a lot of the things that we discuss, and he's been held up as a bastion of freedom. Yeah, when you really look at Noam Chomsky's writing, what he promotes is social libertarianism. Now, that is a definite. Now, that's a combination of two different phrases: socialism and libertarianism. Now, socialism, by its very nature, is lots and lots and lots of government, whereas libertarianism is government so small as to barely be considered government at all. With socialism, you have no choice but to pay heavy taxes so you can provide for the welfare of others. Provide for the welfare of the state, provide for everything. Look at our socialist programs today. Medicaid, Social Security, all of these things are socialist ideas. Unions are socialist ideas. The socialists brought them to us. Thank you very much, Marx. You know, and again, there, you know, it goes back to corrupting ideas and trying to get people to think that something is good, or trying to corrupt those ideas that somebody has of limited government, twist them a little bit, interject big government back into it, and misdirect the people into thinking that they're preaching about freedom and you know, freedom and individualism, where everybody who's ever read anything about socialism knows that there is no individualism allowed in a socialist society. All for one and one for all, if you will, and all of your one goes to everybody else in the country, or society, or whatever it is. You know, you cannot have these ideas intermixing. Socialism and libertarianism do not mix, just like socialism and republic do not mix. They cannot mix. It's an oxymoron to even consider these two concepts merging together into one, because then all you have, again, is socialism. Anytime you interject socialism into any kind of other political philosophy, you have socialism at the core root of it. You know, so I know a lot of people out there, you know, love Noam Chomsky, hate to burst your bubble, but the guy's a socialist. There we go. There's my little rant for the moment.
Oh, that's interesting, because I thought Noam Chomsky was a patriot rock star.
No, Noam Chomsky. Noam Chomsky is one of those guys. You know, I'm going to tell it like it is, man. Noam Chomsky wrote a book called Manufactured Dissent, and in this book, he said that if you take a look at the political movement of the 60s and the 70s, you'll find that it was all that whole movement was created by professors at the big schools, especially coming out of Chicago. And anybody who's studied anything about Chicago knows that from the University of Chicago is where socialism was born in this country, thanks to the Rockefellers. Government control, all these socialist ideas started being promoted and propagated out of the University of Chicago. So he goes on to say that now you can tell that this was a planned directive because they were being told what to do. And these professors and educators, you know, in our schools of higher learning would go out there and they would tell the people what to think, what to say, how to say, and why. He goes, now you can see that there was a, and those movements were very effective, he said. Now, he said, if you look around in the 80s, the 90s, and the 2000s, he says, our movements out there are not as effective because we go out there and we do a lot of chanting, but we don't know what we're saying. We make a lot of demands, but we don't know what it is that we want. We chant slogans left and right, but we don't even know what they mean. And he says, and this was planned because the professors are no longer being told to go out there and create these movements anymore. He goes, it was the professors that were behind the movements of the 60s and 70s because they were told to be. Now, if we look back at exactly what he's saying there, well, he was one of those professors in the 60s and 70s. He was being told what to do, according to him. And he also, in the 80s and the 90s and the 2000s, is very, very, very silent. The only thing he does is write paperback books that he charges you $45 a piece for, telling you again how bad the government is, but not doing anything about it. So in his very own words, he himself was manufactured dissent, controlled dissent, dissent created by those powers that be to steer the masses towards their way of thinking, to control the dissent, to control their actions. Now, if we look back at the movements of the 60s and 70s, they were talking about more and more and more freedom, yet what they were actually promoting was more and more and more socialism and communitarianism. Well, not communitarianism, communism. Look at all the hippies that wanted to live on the communes. Now we have communitarianism, according to George Bush, Jr., you know, we have this new type of government coming in globally called communitarianism. It's fascism for those at the top, you know, ultimate power and control, merger of corporations and merger of business and government, and communism for us down below, the its. We will be the communist slaves, and they will get to enjoy all the bells and whistles of fascism and ultimate control at the top. It's all the exact same thing, though. Hitler even wrote a letter to Stalin talking about his fascist government in comparison with Stalin's socialism, and he basically just said fascism was a fast track to socialism, and which both lead, you know, he says socialism is one step away from communism, so fascism is the exact same aspect, and democracy is two steps away from socialism. Funny how we're being called a democracy now, isn't it? We were never a democracy, though, we're a republic. So, yes, Noam Chomsky is manufactured dissent straight from his own books and his own mouth.
Right, and it's kind of interesting, that kind of common tactic, where it's very Masonic, too. They tell you all the awful things they are either are doing or will be doing to you, and then, interestingly enough, it's always pretty much consistent. And so, in the instance of Monsieur Chomsky, it would seem to be very much the case. So, yeah, so libertarian socialism is the same thing as saying, I love asparagus and I hate asparagus. You know, it's supposed to be a contradiction. It's not supposed to be, like, even if you disagreed with it, it doesn't matter because it's not even logically valid. So obviously it's an oxymoron. Much like how, I guess you could say it's a misnomer to have this subfield or sub-ideology or whatever, that's called anarcho-communism, which is interesting because that's a contradiction too, because even if you believe in communism as a valid political perspective or whatever, the problem is to actually implement communism, you necessarily need the state for a really quick, guidepost, kind of like how you have the the Bill of Rights. Well, look at the 10 planks of the Communist Manifesto. I mean, those planks, you need the coercive power of the state to implement that heavy progressive income tax, to have that central bank, to abolish private property, have public schools, and the rest of it. So claiming you can somehow have communism sans the state. And here's the problem. It is true that Marx, to a certain degree, was an anti-statist, But here's the other problem. I mean, he was also intellectually lazy as well in regards to a lot of things. So, I mean, whether you want to view him as a useful idiot or a controlled opposition, it really doesn't matter. You cannot have, like, an anarchical communism. It's, again, I love asparagus and I hate asparagus. You know, it's just completely just nuts. Now, here's the other interesting thing, too, is I think, Randy, you mentioned about the I think you mentioned in passing moment a couple moments ago about the Libertarian Party.
Mm-hmm.
You know, this is interesting. You know, usually when you have a political party, it's not based on a philosophy or ideology and orientation, you know, whatever the hell you want to call it. It's, you know, based on something else. And, yeah, they have a platform or whatever, but political parties, generally speaking, don't name themselves after, you know, an orientation. You know, the LP is very unique that way. We are the Libertarian Party, the third, the largest third party in the United States. You know, all the other third parties are, even cumulatively, put them all together, are still smaller than we are. You know, that's their kind of big claim to fame. And, you know, besides looking at their track record of how many people they've been able to get into the political office running under an LP ticket, which obviously is observable by anyone with, you know, two brain cells to rub together, even if you want to put that aside for a moment, you know, here's the thing. If you're a consistent libertarian, I think it would be fairly accurate to argue that you shouldn't like partyarchy. Partyarchy being defined as rule by a party. You shouldn't like partyarchy. And, you know, and also, you know, there are certain strains of, you know, so-called revolutionary theory, which one of which is known as a vanguard revolutionary strategy. And by vanguard, usually, and this kind of gets into like the pinko, commie, fascist crap or whatever, but, you know, if you do a vanguard or use a vanguard revolutionary strategy, you necessarily, you know, by its definition, you need to have a party, a political party to put that forward. And it's kind of a comparison, especially in terms of predictive programming. I find it interesting that if you, you know, pick up a copy of 1984, isn't it interesting that Orwell never gave a precise name to the entity known as the party? It was just called the party. Notice it was never the...
Go ahead.
Yeah, it's okay. I was quickly finishing with saying that, look, I noticed that it wasn't anything specific. It was the party. So it could be the commies. It could be the National Socialists. It could be any one of a 5,000 different things. But hell, if we're going to be intellectually honest, it could be something like the Libertarian Party as well. All it was this kind of shadowy kind of thing that sees the, you know, reins of government and whatever. And kind of the problem when you do have partyarchy, even if they're not in control of the government, is that they're kind of like a wannabe, or they otherwise want to push their way so that they can control the government, because that's like the whole point of a political party, is to control the government for the most part. And, you know, getting into various details about whether political parties exist in either a hegemonic two-party system or a dominant one-party system or the multi-party systems like they've got in various Central and South American countries is really not important, because political parties vie for the coercive power of the state to rule their subjects. I mean, that at the end of the day is what's happening. So let's look at that contradiction too. So you have a political party which is not only based on having maximum amount of liberty under this thing called the state, but it's also designed to seize control of the state. So what you literally have is this claim, literally, that, oh yeah, we can form a political party and seize control of the state in order to minimize it. Now, this is interesting. Let's look at their track record. How successful has the LP been in doing that, and how long have they been around?
They've been around for 40 years now.
Now, this is interesting, too. And, Randy, you mentioned Murray Rothbard before. who were the guys that started the LP again?
That would be Murray Rothbard and Hans Hoppe, my two professors.
Yeah. Now, that's interesting. So Rothbard's an anarchist, right?
Anarcho-capitalist.
Specifically. Okay, so this is interesting. So now when you actually use a little bit of, you know, rationality, I think the contradiction should be really clear besides my sarcastic tone. So you have an anarchist who and his other buddies who basically either start or whatever a political party to seize control of the state or to minimize it. But the whole point of a political party is to seize control of the state and, you know, coercively force everybody to do stuff. But isn't that against what anarchism is about? I don't know. It's kind of like saying, you know, I want to go protect people by running around and punching them in the face. You know, it's, again, I love asparagus and I hate asparagus. I mean, like, where is he coming from? Now, I know the typical libertarian thing is, well, if we can seize control of the state and minimize it, we can increase liberty for everybody. We can throw the tyrants out and everything will be fine. That has literally been the libertarian claim for, if you really want to go far back, technically 300 years, if you want to go back to Adam Smith or thereabouts. And we can see the track record. The state gets bigger and bigger all the fucking time. I haven't seen anything where this, I mean, to throw Ron Paul into it too, in that kind of different way. So again, I mean, look at the history, guys.
Well, you know what's interesting though is, you know, let's take a look at some of these ideas. You know, anarchism. We talked about individual freedom, with no government or very, very ultra limited government. We have libertarianism, which preaches individualism, individual rights and freedoms, with limited to no government. We've got classical liberalism, which preaches the rights of the individual as being paramount, with limited to no government. We've got a republic, which preaches individualism, individual freedoms, natural law, if you will, with limited to very limited government. Now, that's something that all of these things have in common. They all preach very much the same thing. Now, anarchism, if we look back at it, anarchism is a society that basically has no government. It's a collection of people who stick together for common good, common purpose, common benefit. Each does as they will with no coerciveness, no strong arm of the law, if you will. You know, as Joe Martino has said, all legislation is enforced at the end of a barrel. Therefore, they really don't have legislation, but they have some common rules of good etiquette, if you will. You know, do as you will, as long as you don't harm another person. That's all fine and well, as long as your little body of individuals doesn't interact with other people. How do you then enforce your anarchist ideas upon them and expect them to behave in a like manner, especially when dealing with trade? How do you regulate trade? Well, they wouldn't regulate trade, so trade would just go on as however. And, you know, a free market, if you will, would reign, supposedly. We saw the effects of that, though, during our Articles of Confederation. The government really had no power during that time. That was truly, I mean, if you look back at the Articles of Confederation, that was a true anarchist, well, not so much an anarchist, well, very much an anarchist slash libertarian slash classical libertarian slash true republic style of government there. Each state was supreme in its own power, with the federal government having no power. But you also saw what happened to it. Trade became a weapon. Commerce was a weapon. All of these things were a weapon that they used against each other. You know, I was sitting in class with Murray Rothbard one day, and we were discussing libertarianism versus anarchism, anarcho-capitalism, all, you know, these just broad general terms. And we were discussing the libertarian revolution also. Now, the libertarian revolution is an interesting concept. It's a nonviolent concept. It's basically a reawakening of people's individualism and desire for freedom and liberty. And it basically, what it stemmed upon was free trade, open borders, reduction of government, including government services that are there now, for instance, courts, police, or peace officers, all being handled by businesses, if you will, corporations. Rothbard used the example of insurance companies being the ideal holders of these because that would serve many benefits there as well. An insurance company would wish to enhance people's right to keep and bear arms to protect private property. If you have your gun and somebody breaks into your house and you kill them, They won't steal your property or cause injury to you, which means the insurance companies won't have to pay out money. The police would protect your freedom so you could do this, so the police wouldn't have to engage and deal with all of this external, you know, additional crime that an unarmed society produces. Judges would also respect our freedoms because we hire them on a community-by-community basis. So basically what you have there is merger of business and government again. Businesses, privatized businesses, fulfilling the roles that government is normally traditionally held. I asked Murray Rothbard what was the difference then between what he was talking about and what we have now. Because we have corporations that control all aspects of our business. We have open borders. We have free trade. We do have free trade according to the libertarian philosophy. Companies can go anywhere they want in the world, build their goods and bring them back into this country being produced with slave labor, and there's no recourse whatsoever. There's no benefit to them staying here in America when they can go pay Chinese slave labor, you know, a dollar a day versus having to pay an American X amount of dollars per hour. And I asked him, you know, what's the difference then between that and what we have now? He was kind of dumbfounded for a minute because I saw through the shill of it all. You know, we're talking about privatization of all government functions, including roads and road maintenance, things like that. And when you get down to it, and I was having this discussion actually on outlaws and outcasts or something with another individual who thinks that they're a libertarian and has all these libertarian ideas about open borders, primarily because his wife is an illegal alien. That's why he wants those laws enacted. But, you know, he wanted, you know, visa, you know, work visas for all these illegals to come up and they can work and pick our crops and do whatever and come up here and then take that money and go home. Well, if that's the case, we've already had that libertarian revolution because that's what we have now. We have an open border. We have 20, 30 million illegal aliens here working 20, 30 million jobs that Americans should have. We have corporations that produce and build everything except here in, you know, everywhere in the world except here in the U.S. We have merger of corporate, you know, we basically have corporate takeover of government now. They run our police. They influence our police to the highest level. They influence our courts to the highest level and our politicians to the highest level. In fact, and if you look at our government history, and if you look at the history of the individuals that are in government now, you'll find that their entire background has been nothing but going from big business, corporate business, into government for a short period of time. They get laws enacted that benefit their big corporations. Then they leave the government for a small period of time, go back to work in the big corporations, do more work there. Then they come back into government, enact laws which benefit those corporations or their agendas for that corporation, and then they leave and they go back and forth again. You know, the FDA is a prime example of this. The FDA,
Basically, the revolving door concept, basically. I mean, that's what happens when you have an oligopolized economy, basically. A cartel system, if you will. Big food, big oil, big whatever it happens to be this week. And it all exists because they all cheat. They're all corporatists. And, they cheat. It's totally, like, not free market at all. And so that kind of screws it up if you try to actually come up with something innovative that'll help make people's lives better. And that's what the bad guys do. So, yeah, and it's all done with government privilege. That's what I mean by cheating. You know, if they didn't have government privilege, the coercive power of the state protecting them, then a lot of this stuff wouldn't be happening. Maybe not all of it, but at least a lot of it, yeah. I mean, the FDA, especially with Monsanto, please. And then, of course, you have to consider that corporations are created by the government.
Well, there are entities of the government that exist that exist by the will of the government. Anytime you open up a corporation, whether it's a nonprofit, a C corp, an S corp, or whatever it is, you have to have a permit to run that corporation. The state has to approve that corporation and its board. And also, if you look at many states, most states, in fact, like California, anytime a corporation is brought into power, the state guidelines and laws say that at any time the state wishes or when they see fit or need, they can come in, dissolve the board, and replace that board with the government or with a board of their choosing. So you basically have a company that is allowed to exist at the good graces of the government, and at any time the government doesn't like you or that board, they will replace you. So you better behave.
Right, exactly. And so that's kind of like a really, really, really big problem. And that kind of makes the difference between somebody that just, you know, through normal free market processes, they come up with a good idea, then they, you know, basically gather capital together and then hire people or whatever, and they try and make a go of business. That's genuine free market activity. But these guys, no. If it's a cartel system, it's known as an oligopoly. A cartel, and exists by government privilege. I mean, look at lobbying. That's probably one of the best proofs of that kind of government privilege, and it's a form of cheating. It's exactly what it is. These guys aren't fairly competing, and it's not just a situation like Enron or anything. It's worse than that. I mean, look at like the major telecommunications companies. Look at like Verizon, AT&T, a bunch of other ones I can't remember right this second. You know, I mean, my goodness, look at the histories. I mean, that's what I find funny, too, is because, and here's another contradiction. You know, I was kind of looking up some anarchist material a few months back, and they were trying to make the case about, well, you know, if the free market can provide private security services and do it well, then we can basically have private police and and whatever. And obviously, since the state only exists for security reasons, if the free market can provide that, we can abolish the state. That doesn't sound crazy. That sounds good, right? Here's the problem. When they tried to, I remember this one specific thing, and I don't remember the professor's name right offhand, but it was like an hour-long presentation somewhere on YouTube. Oh, yeah, because YouTube said so, right? Basically, the worst thing about it was that he was constantly using examples of corporations having private security. And I'm like, oh, my goodness sakes. The private real free market is not the same thing as this corporate hive mind board thing like Walmart or whatever version happens to be this week that go about and, you know, wreck both the environment as well as the economy, you know, as well, too. It's just like, my goodness sakes. I mean, you know, you don't use something bad that technically you should be against prove why the thing you want to make happen is actually good. In this case, you don't use corporations that go about in bad behavior like Disney, for example, and use the example of Disney police or Disney corporate police as an example why private police would work, because it's not the same thing. See, that's the big problem, right? Is people get corporations and actual real private activity mixed up all the time. You know, if I want to barter with my neighbor for good services and even ideas, you know, neither of us is lobbying the government. Neither of us is cheating. It's all, I guess you could say it's fair. But it's, again, with free market processing, it's playing by normal rules of supply and demand and everything else. And so it's just, wow. I mean, so in the attempt to do something good, you know, the anarchists really kind of shoot themselves in the foot, and they kind of have a habit of doing this. Libertarians, too. It's kind of unfortunate. You know, for guys that kind of sit around doing a lot of theorizing, not all, but most of the time, you think they would have thought of better examples that don't commit, like, amateur mistakes of, like, contradictions or whatever. You know, they shouldn't be that intellectually lazy, since that's kind of, like, most of what they do.
Well, I think what happens is that they spend so much time thinking about it and branching off on all these different ideas that eventually they just, you know, they end up with a neural short circuit, if you will, and they've branched out and expanded upon all these different ideas that they don't realize that some of these ideas are intersecting with opposing ideas, and they can't see it, and then they become so dogmatic with this, with their mantra, with their indoctrination, that they refuse to be able to see anything past it.
You know, and it's funny you should mention that. And it's funny you should mention use the word dogmatic, because in a lot of ways it can function kind of like a religion. So you're a Christian, you're a Muslim, you're a social libertarian, a libertarian socialist. You know, it's just like another religion. It's like, oh my gosh, that was not the idea behind libertarianism, or, oh my gosh, look at another huge school of thought, which is known as individual anarchism. I mean, my goodness, I mean, there are some good people out there that I've met and whatever, but there's also some other folks, especially in the alternative media, that are quite religious about it. It's kind of weird, even when they're wrong. It's just kind of weird to see that. It's like, wow, you might as well be a Baptist. I mean, it's really bad in some cases. Even when you say, what about this? What about this concern? What about that contradiction? You know, I'm not saying you're bad, but these are some points that kind of concern me. Can you sit down and talk about it? No. You're acting like the government. Whoa, that's like, whoa, gee whiz, man. I just wanted to learn more about your thing, but sorry, I didn't mean to, you know, elicit such a visceral reaction. Damn.
You know, it's funny, you know, when I asked Murray Rothbard about that, when he was discussing this, I said, you know, this sounds a lot like fascism. And he said, oh, no, well, it's much different. You know, you have this and this sounds much like fascism. And I think I kind of short-circuited his train of thought there, because he just kind of stared at me for a minute and kept talking and never really addressed the fact that, yes, it is much like fascism already. You know, what he's discussing is fascism. He goes, no, it's completely different. It's much more benign. I said, benign fascism is still fascism. You know, and that's basically what you have. You have merger of government and private and private business or corporations or whatever it is. You have a merger of the two. That is fascism.
Now, I'm interesting you should mention that, because you were mentioning also earlier about, like, the quasi-insurance companies. And for those guys who are not, you know, hip or whatever to anarchist terminology, which is why we're kind of doing this particular episode, there's something that's now called a dispute resolution organization. Dispute resolution organization, known in by acronym as a DRO. And so basically the DRO is kind of, and it's kind of a stretch to say it's like a quasi-government, but the point is that those are your private police. And they also do a kind of, you know, several other functions as well. But, you know, hey, you know, Randy, I mean, you bring up a good concern. You know, is it possible to have, assuming that the that anarchism, which, of course, if we're going to play with verbicide and semantics, is now being referred to now as the stateless society. So, guys, you're a stateless society. That's anarchism. It's the same thing.
Well, Murray Rothbard called himself an anarcho-capitalist, that he believed in government.
Yeah, that's a contradiction. Then he shouldn't be an anarcho-anything, capitalist or otherwise, because if he believes in government, by definition, he can't be an anarchist. Again, I love asparagus and I hate asparagus. It's double.
Well, again, though, you know, anarchism isn't the belief in no government. It's little to no government. You can have little government. I mean, Thomas Jefferson believed in government so small as to barely be recognizable as government. I agree with that. 17 powers were delegated to Congress.
Oh, of course, the worst part, too, is that, you know, you just mentioned about anarchy being without government. And, yeah, that's true. Although, you know, there's a couple other different kinds of anarchists that are more commie-like, let's put it that way. And they will kind of – I've seen this on YouTube, too, where you'll have, like, blogger A and blogger – or, sorry, anarchist blogger A and anarchist blogger B and anarchist blogger C all, you know, make videos and kind of rip each other apart or whatever. But, like, one of the things when they'll do that is that, oh, you know, anarchy is not about, you know, government power necessarily. It's about getting rid of hierarchy. Getting rid of hierarchy. And that's, like, all they'll say. And it's like, really? Hierarchy? Really? Really? Okay, you see, if you just leave it at that and you don't, like, define terms or get a little bit more specific, it otherwise sounds very vague. It's kind of like saying, you know, we want equality. What do you mean by equality? I mean, technically, if you break open any standard freshman political science textbook, you will literally have at least seven different kinds of equality. Everything from political equality, which is different from social equality, which is different from legal equality, which is different from economic equality, which is different from equality of opportunity, and like one other one I don't remember right this second.
Well, you know that.
You know, it's like hierarchy the same way.
I know that complete and utter sense of equality is a very communist / socialist idea anyways. We're all the same. You know, I am not going to get the same, you know, I'm not going to have the same economic equality, let's say, as a Rockefeller. You know, I will not be able to go out there and buy my own Learjet whenever the hell I please. So therefore, that's unfair. I'm not equal in that sense, and that's bad, according to, you know, those to those, you know, people who are indoctrinated in that whole concept of equality. An individual who has a 89 IQ is not going to be able to get on this broadcast to compete with me on equal footing with any kind of intellectual discussion about anything. So therefore, I'm bad for having a higher IQ than him. I should be put down because I make him feel inferior, and he's not equal with me. Therefore, in order to get rid of those who are superior, you must get rid of them so everybody is then equal. I don't know how you get equality. I believe in the fact that everybody has the right to determine their own destiny. And, you know, hey, if a guy with an 89 IQ can go out there and become the next Rockefeller, there's more power to him. But the chances of that happening are slim to none. So therefore, he's not going to have the equal chance of becoming, you know, the next Bill Gates, if you will. I am not, you know, I am by no means the equal of many people out there intellectually. Therefore, I'm never going to have my chance to teach at Harvard or Yale or Stanford or Princeton or any other Ivy League school and promote my ideas. So, you know, this whole concept of equality, we're all given an equal chance to enjoy our life, to get whatever it is that we can get out of it individually, but nothing is promised to you, and that's the concept. You know, and that's the same thing that all of these governmental types promote and preach. You know, and that's the funny thing. You know, when you look at anarchism, libertarianism, classical liberalism, res publica, what do you have? You have the same basic doctrine, the same basic mantra: limited government, free people, association by choice. I don't have to associate with this individual if I don't want to. People are free to come and go as they will. They can engage in the concepts of free speech. They can express their ideas openly without fear of retribution from government. Freedom of religion, things like this. They all preach the same thing. You know, and that's what I had a hard time understanding from Murray Rothbard is, what's the difference between what you're talking about in classical liberalism or any of these other things, except that you've engaged, you know, you've added a concept of fascism to it? You know, again, we take these little ideas that we like, we change them up a little bit, and we have a whole new concept now. We've got 500 different forms of anarchism out there. We've got 10,000...
Oh, no kidding.
You know, we got 500 different versions of libertarianism now. There was one. When I knew Murray Rothbard, there was just libertarianism. Now you got anarcho-capitalism, you got socio-libertarianism, you got communitarianism. My God, please, just stop. You know, and the thing is, you know, we keep creating more and more of these dividing factors amongst us, and we can't even agree on our own political ideas. Libertarians don't agree on libertarianism. Anarchists don't agree on anarchy. And the
Speaking on that point that anarchists don't even agree, you know, I put into the chat room a little bit earlier, and for you guys listening on the podcast version, I'll describe this very briefly. On Wikipedia, if you look for anarchist, I think it's anarchist symbolism, I think are the key words. If you scroll through that article, there should be a picture. It's technically an SVG file, but it shows the anarchist flags and stars. And with it, yeah, they have their own flags, for those of you guys who didn't know. And this isn't like all of them. This is only six different kinds of anarchism. Only six. There's actually more, a lot more. But there are the six flags, and so just very briefly, the red and black flag is the one that's used by the anarcho-commies, as well as the anarcho-syndicalists. The syndicalists, those are the like organized
anarcho-communists. How the hell does that happen? Because communism would, in my definition of left and right, and the classical definition of left and right, communism is on the far right. It is so
right, exactly.
So how do you have anarchy? Anarchism was merging with totalitarianism. How does that happen?
It can't. And like what I mentioned earlier, is that you necessarily need the state if you're going to be a good communist, just or a good rank and file communist anyway. It's again a contradiction. I love asparagus, but I hate asparagus. Next one, anarcho-capitalism. That's gold and black, or yellow and black. You know, then there's green anarchism, which is also known as anarcho-primitivism. So that's green and black. Anarcho-primitivism. Those are the guys who want to, after we abolish the state, they want to, like, have everyone, like, not use electricity or at least computers or something to that degree, because technology, it's, I don't want to make them sound bad, but it's kind of a little bit like being a, like, Luddite, but it's not quite like that. It's more that the state and the corporations have invented these evil technologies to enslave us, and so to free ourselves and gain liberty, we need to return to the land and live in log cabins or some such thing. I mean, that's and ironically, a lot of the anarcho-primitivists, I've actually known some.
That sounds like those eco-fascists.
Funny you should say that. The anarcho-primitivists, a lot of them haven't even gone camping, at least of the ones that I've met. I'm like, okay, well, you know, I was a Boy Scout. I know what camping's like. It's not cool not having a toilet. I mean, that's like a basic thing. We don't even get anything else. I mean, just like, I mean, you want toilets or not? I mean, when you say you don't like the technology, I mean, how far are you really willing to push that? Are we talking on-grid, off-grid, your own grid? What kind of thing are we talking about? But a lot of the anarcho-primitivists are like, you know, screw toilets. Toilets are evil. They're an invention of the state or whatever it happens to be this week. Anyway, another one, anarcho-feminism. It's purple and black. Well, wait a minute. I thought feminism was invented by, who are those old guys that, like, want to take over the world or whatever? What were their names? They kind of funded. Aaron Russo talked about them, too. They're kind of a family. Starts with an R. Founded Chase Manhattan Bank. Oh, my gosh. They funded the feminists.
And it was promoted by, none other than Bernays back in the 20s.
Right, exactly.
Remember all those, remember the 20s when all those billboards started coming out with women smoking, little miniskirts and stuff like that? Who was the mass
Torches of Liberty. That? Torches of Liberty. That's exactly how Bernays marketed it. Torches of Liberty. I got to love that.
Yes, but yeah, I mean, women.
Like, yeah, freeing them to experience lung cancer and everything else or whatever the case is. Or whatever, but the point was just a total mind control campaign. I think at the very least that's the provable part. But yeah, I mean, look at like the major feminist leaders. I mean, like Margaret Sanger, who's a well-known racist and hated black people and wanted to kill her children off with abortion, provably. Go look at the records, don't believe me. Margaret Sanger, a eugenicist. There was also Gloria Steinem.
It wasn't just black people that she hated. She hated the ITs. You know,
right.
And she hated the ITs. And who are the ITs? The ITs are we common people, the common man out there, as Plato called us. Plato called us the ITs. It was the common man. She said children are like weeds. She didn't say black children. She didn't say Indian, you know, Native American children or Asian children. She said children are weeds. You know, it's all comes
right.
down to population.
Well, I mean, that's
control.
Not
yeah,
good
that's,
either.
You know, it all comes down to population control in that aspect as well. Eugenics is nothing but the science of elitism. And in order to be elite, you cannot have the ITs overpowering you, because when the ITs get more powerful than you, the elites, well, we get rid of you, the elites, and we become free. So how do you get rid of the ITs? Well, you get rid of the kids. You make it so they kill each other off. You send them off to war to die. While you make billions and billions of dollars of corporate profits, or whatever the case may be, governmental profits, or whatever. You know, that's an interesting concept, too, because, you know, we're talking about the elites, you know, who some of us hold up as, you know, these bastions of whatever it is. And, you know, let's talk about Ayn Rand.
Oh, you know, Ayn Rand.
You know, Ayn Rand, she is, you know, the author of such books as Hammerhead, Atlas Shrugs. You know, she's this bastion of common, you know, of free markets or so forth and so on, and these libertarian ideals. Yet Ayn Rand was a cultist. She was a totalitarian. She was an elite from Russia. She was the mistress of the head of the Rothschild family for many, 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 many years. She hated the libertarians. She hated their ideas of individualism. She despised them. She ran her Ayn Randian society as a cult to the point of banishment, and including family members that were banished. You yourself were no longer allowed to speak to your own family members or suffer the wrath of Rand. You know, Murray Rothbard did an incredible paper on her. You know, I believe it was called The Cult of Rand.
Yeah, actually, last time I checked, that was one of the places it's located. I was on Lou Rockwell's site at lourockwell.com, I think it was. But yeah, I remember reading that. It was actually pretty funny. I think it was like a satire piece or some such thing that Rothbard did, because if I remember correctly, Rothbard and Rand actually met each other, initially liked each other a little bit or something, but then pretty much later they had a falling out because Rothbard kind of saw through her bullshit, which was kind of not cool. It's kind of interesting, you know, we have the liberty of association, but, you know, there is such a thing known as, like, abusing your liberties. You know, kind of like, again, the liberty of bearing arms. Okay, how do you abuse that? You know, you go kill innocent people or whatever, you know, civilians, whatever the case is. So how do you abuse liberty of association? You arbitrarily and unfairly, you know, screw with them as to who they can associate with, which, again, I think is what the cultish type behavior, I think is what you're referring to, is an abuse of that particular liberty, I think is what you're pretty much getting at. And, yeah, it's kind of awful, too. Like, you slightly disagree on something, or worse, you don't even make a decision. You just ask a question. And I've done this with other libertarians, and, you know, some, it's not most of the ones I've met. Most of the ones I've met are actually pretty cool. But some of them, it's like, hey, dude, what about this contradiction? Or what about this other thing? Did you ever consider this? Or let's do some compare and contrasting. Or hell, let's just have some fun and do and experience some cognitive dissonance and see if we can, like, grow or whatever. And no, that's evil. Can't do that. We do that, we're like the statists. I'm like, well, hold on a second. You have contradictions. And we already know that the statists, basically statists are guys who like government, like, way the hell too much. They're basically, you know, people who are statists are basically butt buddies with the government, to put it one way. I mean, they just like, I love the government. You know, those are statists. And they come in various flavors, fascists, commies, and the rest of them. But, yeah, it's kind of funny to see that, you know, you'll have certain, you know, libertarians just like, no, just if you disagree with me even slightly, you're part of the government, or you like the government, or you're on welfare, whatever the case is. Like, dude, just want to talk. I mean, we don't have to agree on everything. We're all individuals, right? You know, we were all little automatons. If we're all little automatons and agreed on everything, whether that's libertarianism or anything else, if we didn't have some level of disagreement or just differing thoughts, even if they're not a disagreement, just differing thoughts on something, then we wouldn't be individuals, right? Wait, I thought that was diversity. Wait, diversity and tolerance, right? Oh, wait, can't have that either, right? I'm just saying, I mean, it's kind of sad that, you know, libertarians, at least the mainline libertarians, have always billed themselves as being very cosmopolitan. You know, in fact, actually, you know, it's been mentioned in various places about how, like, for example, on this website, libertarianism.com, on the page where it's mentioned about libertarianism 101, there's this sentence that says, quote, libertarianism is best the combination of liberty, meaning the freedom to live your life in any peaceful way you choose, responsibility, the prohibition against the use of force by others except in defense, and what they're really meaning is the initiation of force, but anyway. And tolerance, meaning honoring and respecting the peaceful choices of others. Now, I find this funny about tolerance, that that's like a core libertarian. If you want to look at that triad of liberty, responsibility, and tolerance equaling libertarianism, if you want to view it in terms of an equation. You know, I find it funny on that one variable of tolerance, that there are some libertarians I've met that are really not very tolerant. And, you know, going back to Ayn Rand, it kind of would make sense that she's not a libertarian because she was anything but tolerant. She violated that core value.
No, again, though, you know, when we look at Ayn Rand and what she wrote, she wrote very much like Plato did. She wrote something that the masses believed was for them, the concepts of liberty and things like that, but we were too stupid not to be able to read past what she was actually saying. She was writing those books for the elite. She was writing those books for the Rockefellers, the Carnegies, the Mellons, the DuPonts, the Rockefellers, the Rothschilds. Those were who were those books were written for. And that every man, what was his name, John Gall, was not the common man, but it was the average, everyday power elitist, if you will. That's who John Gall was. You know, she even said so much in her own memoirs and her own writings. She despises the concepts of liberty and freedom, yet we hold her up as a bastion of freedom, a bastion of the concepts of free markets and free enterprise, a bastion of, you know, free association. Well, yeah, they are free. Just, you know, again, the association, that free association was they were free to associate with the other elites, but not we associate with them. You know, she wrote as Plato did. She wrote for the she wrote books that we thought were for us, but they were really written for the elite. Much like Plato's cave, you know, they describe the people who sit in the cave with their backs turned towards the mouth entrance, and they see all these shadows appearing on the wall, and they make up this whole huge history and religion and mythology and a whole socio-caste based upon it, never realizing that if all they did was turn around, they'd see the truth, a change of perception. And that's right. What Plato was talking about. We all live in Plato's cave, and we're meant to.
Right, and it's kind of funny, too. I don't have the source citation right ahead of me, but guys, if you do a simple like start page search or internet search, try keywords like Ayn Rand hates libertarians or a combination of that, in other words, or something to that effect, and what you should find is the actual source material where she was. It was either like in speeches or a seminar workshop thing or something. She has actually stated publicly that she completely despised libertarians, and kind of bringing it back full circle, at least in one sense, you know, she really despised libertarians, and one of her reasons was because of the formation of the LP, basically partyarchy. So, you know, in that one respect, I, you know, will agree with her about the partyarchy aspect, obviously, but yeah, she was obviously no friend. So again, there's another contradiction. So libertarians like her, but she and the objectivists don't like the libertarians, but then why are the libertarians liking her when she has publicly repudiated them? You see that?
We don't read.
Right.
We read the party approved doctrine and mantras. You know, we read the approved books for libertarians, the approved books for communists, the approved books for conservatives, the approved books for libertarians, the approved eco-fascist books, but none of us truly ever read. And when we do read, we do very little comprehension. Reading is one thing. Understanding what you're reading is something else. You know, people read, you know, I was told to read the Animal Farm, Orwell's book, Animal Farm, back in junior high. I had no comprehension of what it was then. I really didn't understand that it was talking about communism and socialism and all these wonderful things. You know, Orwell himself was a victim of that. Orwell himself was a socialist. He worked for these globalists. He was sent to Spain to bring in socialism there with the overthrow of the Spanish monarchy and the Spanish nobility. But then when what he saw there in Spain was not what he signed up for, if you will. He saw murder. He saw rapes and torture. He saw the Spanish Inquisition being done by socialists. And then he realized, once he started moving up the echelon, you know, because he was now hanging out with people like the Darwins, the Wedgwoods. He was hanging out with the H.G. Wellses, who was raised by one of the Rothschilds in his own home. He was being brought up, he was intermixing and intermingling with these individuals. And then he started getting the bigger picture because he was one of the good workers. And he started getting a little bit more trust. And then he started being filled into the whole story of what was going on in the overall plan. And that's when he realized this is not a workers' revolution. This is not a people's revolution. This is an elitist revolution meant to get rid of us all and to gain control of everything. And that's when he ran back here and started trying to get his books published that were promised to be published. But all the publishing houses were, again, owned by those that he used to work for. The Rockefellers, who owned like 90%, 97% of all the publishing homes across in the U.S. and nationwide, and his books couldn't get published. You know, but even he was a victim of lack of comprehension. He couldn't see beyond what he was being told, what he was reading.
Right, right. And, you know, and also look at, like, the major figureheads, too. I mean, again, like, with feminism, you know, Margaret Sanger, Gloria Steinem, who was a known CIA asset. So, you know, she's working for the bad guys or whatever. So I never go feminism, really. But, yep. You know, let's look at the big libertarian folks. I mean, look at the folks we've mentioned so far. Ayn Rand, Noam Chomsky, Murray Rothbard. You know, nobody noticing a pattern with those three just by themselves. You know, guys, figure it out. But, you know, there's also a couple other problems, too. I mean, like, okay, there's this common conception, a concept. It's known as the non-aggression principle. I mentioned this in one of my previous podcasts. I don't remember the number right off. It was the one on philosophy. But, you know, the non-aggression principle in a nutshell is basically saying that the initiation of coercive force is always immoral. Okay, so if you rob someone, if you kill them, rape them, do all these horrible crimes, that's violating the non-aggression principle on its face. Now, the non-aggression principle, to be clear, is not pacifism, because the non-aggression principle allows for self-defense, i.e. measuring force with force to repel aggressors and keep yourself alive and happy and safe as much as possible. So in a lot of ways, besides something like the Second Amendment, which is written down, if you want a further justification of self-defense, dude, you got the non-aggression principle on your side, like 1,010%. And usually libertarians and anarchists usually appeal to the Second Amendment, non-aggression principle, because especially the anarchists, they're not really big on that thing called the Constitution, you know, the piece of paper with words written on it, for obvious reasons. So they have to appeal to something else if they want to get into issues of self-defense. So usually they kind of fall back on morality and ethics.
Well, doesn't the issue of
self-defense? They want the non-aggression principle.
But the Constitution deals with issues of self-defense. It comes up with the Second Amendment. You know, we forget that Bill of Rights is not a separate document of itself. That's why they're called amendments. They're amending the Constitution. They are part of that Constitution. It is not a separate body of work. It's one of this. It's an amendment to it. You know, it was an addition that was put to that Constitution. Now, the original Constitution itself only formed government. It spoke of government structure. And that's how, you know, that's the way that is, you know. Me, myself, I think that the Constitution has a bunch of loopholes and cracks in its foundation that have been very, you know, very, very keenly manipulated by attorneys and lawyers, hence the need for the original 13th Amendment to be brought back. We need to get rid of them all. You know, but, you know, I once had a conversation with Murray Rothbard. We were talking about anarchism and libertarianism. And I kind of made a smart-ass remark at the time. And I said, so anarchists are libertarians are what happens when anarchists grow up and realize that you can't have a completely enclosed, encapsulated society when you begin interacting with outside forces, outside influences, like other communities, other cities, other towns, other whatever it is. And he laughed and chuckled, and he goes, pretty much.
Well then, if even Rothbard acquiesced to that, as you're saying with that private conversation you had with him way back when, why is any anarchist waxing eloquent about the stateless society? Again, if Rothbard himself, the almighty Rothbard, if he even agreed with your contention, then why would anyone advocate the stateless society? Unless it's for, like, other reasons or something, but, like, that's kind of a key problem by itself. I mean, it is true that there have been historical examples of some form of anarchism working. I mean, for example, you've got medieval Iceland, medieval Ireland, feudal Europe.
Feudal Europe wasn't really anarchism. I mean,
it was feudalism, fair enough, and monarchy.
That was that was elite rule. That was, you know, totalitarianism in an extreme there again. You know, if you were noble, you could go ahead, chop the head off of anybody it's the peasants that you deemed offended you or didn't move out of your way quick enough.
Right. You know, arguably you could say maybe some communes during the Spanish Civil War. Actually, speaking of Rothbard, he does like to write about Pennsylvania in the 17th century. You could also look at modern Somalia, or whatever that's worth. The only other one would be Kibbutzim. But obviously, these are not terribly convincing historical examples because they're kind of disgender related. Like, I mean, would you seriously want to go up to a run-of-the-mill constitutionalist and say, hey, dude, let's do the anarchism thing? I'm like, why? It's like, because it's been done before. And the guy says, why? It's like, because they did it in medieval Iceland. You know, just even when you're kind of like trying to advertise, even if you wanted to advertise for anarchism using a historical example, saying something like modern Somalia or medieval Iceland doesn't sound that impressive. That's kind of like a big problem.
So let's look at some, you know, some societies did have an anarchist, you know, quote unquote anarchist government. I mean, you know, that, and they worked for the time. They worked for the time because they had limited interaction with others. Trade was done mutually, things like that, open borders, if you will, whatever, but not really open borders. You know, let's look at the Native Americans. You know, they did not have open borders. You could not migrate from one area to another area as a clan and go, you know, lay down your claim there and say, well, we're going to live here now, because that was somebody else's territory. And there was wars fought over that. You know, but in general, they had a leaderless society, if you will. You know, they had they had elders there that were listened to and revered for their wisdom and knowledge, but each man had a say, and each man could come and go as he chose. You know, the individuals, you know, you could leave one tribe and go join another tribe. You were not stuck in the tribe that you were in. And, you know, Jefferson had even said himself, we would do well to, you know, to look at these indigenous government, you know, the indigenous people here and their governmental structure, because, you know, they were free, I guess, in a sense. You know, but then again, though, they had rules within their own society. They had codes of conduct that were acceptable and unacceptable. There was things you could not do and things you could do. There was laws. You know, except that the punishment didn't come down from a government branch, but from the clan itself, you know, society itself, ostracization, banishment, whatever it was. You know, so, I mean, it's just a matter of, you know, but at that point, you know, that comes into that concept of democracy there, though. You know, this group of people decided that you did wrong. It didn't matter whether you had done wrong or not, as long as enough of them thought you did wrong. See what I'm getting at?
Right. It's and so I think kind of like what we're getting at here is that, you know, it's not exactly, you know, the minefield that is libertarianism and anarchism, while the path to hell is paved with, you know, the path to hell is paved with good intentions. You know, it is well intentioned, but unfortunately, whether it's the contradictions or intellectual laziness or whatever the problem is, it's not exactly something that's like super cut and dried. I mean, there are good things to it, again, like the non-aggression principle. Or let's look at one other good thing, because to be fair, we've been kind of bashing it for a bit. While in the good faith efforts to really kind of explain how it all works, but like another thing they like to look at is universal ethics. You know, for example, people like to tell other people to do things, to do certain things, or to avoid doing certain things. Most of the time they appeal to a rule when they do that because people don't like being made to obey another person's opinion. So therefore, in order for a rule to be valid and not just an opinion in disguise, it must be universal. Now, assuming that's true, then ethics would be the application of universal rules to human behavior. Bullying is trying to make other people obey your own subjective preferences by pretending those preferences are universal rules. And, you know, that can be seen in both the personal as well as the political spheres. Absolutely. I mean, especially when you get into the issue of, like, what laws and statutes and all that stuff is. I mean, technically, in a lot of ways, once you consider the oligopolies, the cartel systems, big food, big oil, big whatever, you know, technically whenever they lobby the state, you know, that's technically their own subjective preferences at work, and the state enforces it at the barrel of a gun. Oh, and now that I've mentioned that, let me also be clear just for the listeners. in libertarian parlance, when you hear a guy mention about, like, at the barrel of a gun or the barrel of a gun,
mm-hmm.
in that libertarian terminology, they're not referring to the invention known as the firearm. They're simply using the symbology of that as a way of trying to explain coercive force. So the gun is not the invention of the firearm. It is a symbol for initiation of coercive force by the state. So, for example, these laws are basically a barrel of a gun. When you have these laws or whatever that, you know, force you to do whatever it is, you know, it's being done at the barrel of a gun. When the cop pulls you over and gives you a speeding ticket, that is done at the barrel of a gun. Again, not a physical firearm. It's a symbol of the coercive power of the state. The guy with the guy wearing a blue costume that is willing to injure you and kill you if you don't do what he thinks you should be doing. Because some guy in an empty suit someplace else wrote down a bunch of words on a piece of paper, and then a bunch of other guys in empty suits, you know, did some sort of ceremony, and then they decided that this is what everyone should be doing. Which, technically, by itself, you could think of as subjective preferences if you really want to be consistent about it.
I know the legislation being enforced at the barrel of, you know, at the end of a barrel doesn't, you know, it before the rifle was introduced, it was legislation enforced at the end of a sword, legislation enforced at the end of a pike, legislation enforced at the end of whoever has the biggest club, you know, whatever it was at the time. But it was, you know, legislation enforced with state force. You know, with the power to inflict harm and damage upon you.
Right, exactly. And, you know, that's just something to take into consider when you're looking at the nature of government. Now, Randy, something else you also mentioned earlier was the kind of immigration and open borders issue. And it's funny, because even if you go, I put a link in the chat earlier, but if you guys listening on the podcast version, you know, if you go to libertarianism.com and you go to their issues section, they do have a page on immigration, and it's very, very, if you just read the overview, it's very, very short, as with all the other issue positions. But the nice thing about this particular website, libertarianism.com, the nice thing about it is that it gives you the main line libertarian perspective on whatever the issue is. And even the one on immigration, I'll just quote it, quote, "Immigration is a controversial issue on which reasonable and principled people may disagree. Even within the libertarian movement, there are disagreements about the role and necessity of the state." And they go on to mention pro-open borders, anti-open borders, and the rest of it. Now, I find this funny because if you actually delve deep into more like the Austrian School of Economics and other such related things, there's a concept that is known as the homesteading principle.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I find this funny. Now, let's take like 2 seconds and see if we can find a contradiction or we can prove it's consistent. Okay, so the homesteading principle basically says that, you know, if you find like a plot of land, and it doesn't have to be real estate, this is just an example of a tangible asset of positive value. You find a piece of land and you basically plop yourself down and you improve it, you mow it, you grow crops, you basically make it nice. And then thus, by doing that over a period of time, it becomes your property. Because you're basically a settler. It's kind of like settling the West or something. It's the same concept. That's the homesteading principle. So it's very pro private property, and you make it your own, and you know, you civilize the wild. You want to think of it that way. Now I find this interesting because if you're settling something and you're, I guess you could say, civilizing it, then at some point, you know, if you're putting crops down, I would assume you would have to put up a border at some point. Right, to like fence your property in and to respect private property rights. At some point, some sort of definable border, fence, whatever you want to call it, however you want to think of it as, basically some sort of delineation, some sort of proof that this is where my private property ends, here's where it begins. You know, you have to have your beginnings and your endings, so to speak. Okay, so assuming that the correct explanation, understanding of the homesteading principle, and assuming that really is embraced by libertarians, how the hell can any libertarian embrace open borders? Because technically now you've moved to a national level thing with the country, or however you want to think of it as, where you don't have a definable thing, whether it's a fence or border, however you want to think of it as, that's kind of a problem. So I would argue that's a violation of the homesteading principle. Again, if you are going to be consistent, and I would love somebody to, you know, who's ever hearing this in the future to really kind of come up with a rebuttal for this, because I would love to hear it. But how is a libertarian being pro-open borders, or whatever, however you want to think of it as, can simultaneously be in favor of the homesteading principle? Again, double think. I love asparagus and I hate asparagus. And I would love if somebody could prove me wrong, but I kind of, it just kind of irks me the wrong way. Know what I mean?
Well, the whole concept that the libertarians believe in is, you know, one of the concepts is the right to private property, right?
Mm-hmm.
Well, how do you define private property then? You own it, right?
Well, there's even a strain of anarchists known as propertarian anarchists. And those are lots of different kinds. But basically, the one thing they all have in common is that they are pro-private property. Especially when you get into terms of like means of production and that kind of thing, all private. So even the anarchists on their own end, you know, the propertarian anarchists are very much on that, yeah.
So, you know, again, you know, what I find interesting, though, is that, you know, we keep pointing out all this division, you know, we keep talking about factions, you know, and division, and yet, you know, all of these people are basically preaching the exact same thing that Thomas Jefferson was preaching, correct?
Yeah, for the most part, even the anarcho-feminists, to their credit, to a certain degree, yes, absolutely.
So why do we keep dividing ourselves upon little minute minutiae?
Well, the problem on that one, the problem seems to be, Randy, that, again, kind of like how I mentioned with Ayn Rand kind of abusing the freedom of association, same thing here. You know, typologies, you know, scientists of any field really like to use typologies. You know, we like to give names to things and classify it and try to rationally, especially using the scientific method, basically kind of figure out and make sense of phenomena that we're observing in objective reality. So that's where you have typologies, classification systems. One brief example would be look at botany. Okay, there's like 20 million different kinds of plants or whatever.
Right.
Okay, so when we're looking at social phenomena, like the social sciences, basically stuff dealing with humans where you study humans or whatever, you know, you have typologies for that as well. Now, here's the problem. Now, typologies are good when you use them rationally to distinguish, again, here's the key thing, to distinguish between phenomenon you're observing. However, the intention behind having typology is not to divide things that are essentially the same. So, again, it comes down to a proper use thing and avoiding abuse. So if you use it to distinguish, that's okay, because obviously, you know, a commie is not the same thing as a libertarian. As a simple example, but then if you don't want to divide, again, if you have, here's a really simple thing. If you have anarcho, like as a prefix, and then you have the suffix, syndicalism, communism, capitalism, primitivism, feminism, anarcho-pacifism, that's another one, and, you know, blah, blah, blah. You basically have anarcho-whatever. If you have anarcho-whatever, okay, that is an example where you have such absurd levels, and it is absurd levels of classification to the point that it fails to distinguish, and instead it is unnecessarily dividing, you know, philosophies or ideologies, political perspectives, whatever, that are essentially very similar, because the key thing is that first part is the anarchist part. That's the big thing they've all got in common. And anything after that, it's like minutia. You know, it's kind of a funny thing. You know, it's even a maxim of law that says he who distinguishes well learns well. So typologies are good. Again, he who distinguishes well learns well. So typologies are good, but you don't want to abuse it. Don't be like Ayn Rand, guys, who abused her liberty of association by throwing somebody out who, you know, had like an original thought in their head. Same thing here. Don't, you know, guys, if you're like for those of you guys who are the ANCAPs, that's short for anarcho-capitalist, guys, if you're an ANCAP listening to me right now, you know, don't take the anarcho-feminists or even the ANCOMs, the anarcho-communists, don't take them and throw them under the bus necessarily, because you're all anarchists in the first place. That's the most important thing. I'm just saying. I mean, yeah, okay, there are certain things that with means of production or whatever other issues are that kind of are key. But if you guys are really serious about abolishing the state, you know, I would kind of focus and be more positive and focus on two things. One, your common values, the anarchist part, and then the other thing is, what is your common enemy? In this case, the common enemy of, or the enemy of any real true anarchist of any kind is the state. So, I mean, like, you know, it's not that hard. And please, like another flag I'm looking at is pink and black, and that's for queer anarchism. I mean, that's just getting ridiculous. Queer anarchism, is this a joke? It's kind of the problem. So it's almost like taking something serious, even if it's flawed on its own merit. I don't want to get so much into that. I just want to explain what it is. But even if they passed it, all these unnecessary subdivisions basically bastardize the typology. That's my problem.
You know, if you don't mind, what I'd like to do now, because we've only got about 20 minutes left, and we've got some interesting conversation and topic pieces that are coming up. What I'd like to do now for the last 20 minutes or so is discuss why all these ideas don't work. And if you don't mind, I'll kind of take the lead on this one, because I have this is a subject of conversation that's going on in the chat room right now dealing with open borders.
Sure.
You know, as I mentioned before, the founder of the Libertarian Party was Murray Rothbard. I had the pleasure of being mentored by him, not just a student of his, but mentored by him for 2 years. And not just Murray Rothbard, but his right-hand man, Hans Hoppe, at UNLV. I was one of Murray Rothbard's very first students in 1986 when he first started teaching at UNLV in 1986. And we had many, many discussions like this. And my point of questioning to him was always the same. We have that now. How is it working out for us? So let's look at this concept of open borders, for instance. You know, libertarians, you know, a lot of libertarians and anarchists believe in this open border concept. Well, let's take a look at that. How has that worked out for us? We have that concept now. We have a very open border system now. Every year America gets flooded. You know, in fact, the UN openly stated that the new policy for the U.S. would be massive immigration from diversely differing cultures for the one purpose of destroying the American culture and creating more factionalization within this country. So let's take a look at this. We have open borders now. We have 20 plus million illegal aliens here. We have millions, we have tens and tens and tens and tens of millions of immigrants flooding into this country from other countries, most of them from vastly differing cultures, Middle Eastern cultures, Asian cultures, whatever, you know, whatever you have. They do not understand the concepts of liberty and freedom. They do not understand the concepts of assimilation. So now what we have in America is we have what is going on in Europe. Europe has a very open border policy, and Europe is gone. Europe is destroyed. You know, the minister in charge of immigration, or was it the prime minister of Germany, openly said, in 20 years there will be no more Germans in Germany. So let's look at this. We have open borders now. This is primarily directed at, you know, Hillary Clinton. Is that how it is? Clinton? Yes, Hillary Clinton in the chat room. I'm open for discussion on this. I'm open for discussion on this, you know. I believe in varying viewpoints. You know, let's get to the bottom of it, then. Let's find out what we have and what we have to work with and if it works. You know, let's not believe in something because it's politically correct. But let's believe in something because it's proven to be factual and functional. So we have open borders now in this country. How is that working out for you? We have a massive division in this country and the destruction of our culture here because of immigrants coming in here who come here and they decide that we cannot have our culture here. Our culture is abhorrent to them. It's discriminatory towards them, I guess they might say, because we say things like Merry Christmas.
Yeah, where's the tolerance, right? Remember, guys, that's the key libertarian value is tolerance. So where is it?
So we have open borders now. We have massive immigration. We've had it since the 50s. How has that worked out? You know, the immigrants come here to this country, and that's not all immigrants. You know, again, this is not, you know, I don't generalize. You know, there are some immigrants who come here for that American dream, freedom, liberty. They assimilate to this culture. They assimilate to this culture and become Americans. Nowhere else can I go in this world. Well, it didn't used to be that way. You know, if I want to immigrate to Japan, I must be able to read, speak, and write Japanese fluently. 400 characters, 400 of their kanji, I must be able to read, write, and speak in order to work there. That's not even to get citizenship there. I must assimilate to their culture because they're not going to change their culture for me. So again, well,
the right, and actually the French,
you know,
do the
here
same.
Again, though, okay, he brought up a good point here. But what is the difference between legal and illegal? They are all people. Again, we are not an open society. That Declaration of Independence, that Bill of Rights, does not apply to the world. That was an amendment to the Constitution for these United States of America. Mexico does not abide by that Constitution or that Declaration of Independence or those Bill of Rights. Now, some people might say I'm preaching nationalism here, and that is very true. Now, our founding fathers were very big on nationalism. They said that we will not engage in any tangling alliances. Open trade with everybody. That means that we will produce and manufacture goods here in America. We will trade with people that will trade equitably with us. But the whole provision there was that we would manufacture goods in this country because only through manufacturing and production is true wealth created. When you export all of your manufacturing to outside countries, you lose your independence, you lose your production, you lose the ability to create new wealth.
Yeah, even James Madison in one of the Federalist Papers really complained about that, you know, the colonies vis-a-vis the British back, you know, on the other side of the pond. But, you know, speaking about nationalism, that kind of brings up kind of a key question, Randy. You know, is nationalism compatible with libertarianism?
I believe, well, you know, no, it's not, because, again, you know, I don't really care about Mexico. I don't care about Israel. I don't care about any of the European countries. I don't care about the Middle East. My only concern is the U.S. of A. I'm an American. That is my only concern. I am concerned about the well-being, the security, and the freedoms here in America. And we should be the bastion, the example for those freedoms throughout the world. Now, that does not mean that we take our idea of freedom to the rest of the world at gunpoint with armies of imperialism or whatever it is. It means that other countries should look at us and say, damn, why can't we have that? And therein starts that train of thought that says, why can't we have that? Why can't we be free? And then they take their own freedom just like we took our freedom. You know, something that is given is never cherished. It's never appreciated. It's only when you work for something that it becomes cherished and appreciated, and that you appreciate it. If we give somebody freedom, who's to say that's the freedom they want? I mean, we take democracy to the world, and look at that. Look what happens. We don't take democracy. We implant tyrants and dictators. So, you know, nationalism is important, because if you don't engage in nationalism, which is America first, if we are not secure and safe here in our own homes, if we are not secure and safe with our liberties and freedoms, how can we be the example of that around the world? Let's look at that. We exported all of our, we created the free trade agreement, again, that, you know, free trade, you know, free markets ideas that the libertarians promote. We engaged in that in the 70s with the disgraced President Nixon, a Republican. His job was to deindustrialize the U.S., and he did a really good job of that. He exported all of our jobs to China and throughout the world. How has that concept of free markets worked out for us now? Well, let's take a look at it. Our major components of our military's infrastructure are now built in China. What happens if China decides they don't like us anymore? Our military, you know, is ground to a halt. What happens then? You know, part of that independence is being a self-sufficient society, being able to provide internally for all the needs of the population at hand. If we are not independent economically, If we are not independent on a production and manufacturing level, are we truly free, or are we once again dependent upon someone else? And remember, freedom is a state of independence. How can we be free if we engage in true free market economy, where we have companies leaving and going to China and engaging in slave labor, or to the Philippines, or to Grenada, right, or anywhere else? Let's look at the open border policy, okay? Again, you know, great. You want to come to this country? Great. I have no problem with immigration. Come to this country because you want to be free. But come to this country because you want to be an American. Don't come to this country because you want the entitlements and everything else and then say, well, I'm not American, I'm Nicaraguan, or I'm Mexican, and then try to impose your views and your will upon those people that let you into their country. This is the problem with open borders. So how has the destruction of the American culture worked out for you due to open borders? You know, and we keep talking about that. Everybody keeps talking about open borders and everything like that, and yet we have them. Give me your tired, your poor, your huddled masses yearning to breathe free, the wretched refuse of your teeming shore. Send these, the homeless tempest lost to me. I lift my lamp beside the golden door. Yes, bring them here if they want to be Americans. But if they come here because they want to be something else other than Americans, but to engage upon our freedoms here, to do what they want, to try to change our republic into something else other than what it is, then I say no. And at what point does immigration stop working for us? Do we keep importing millions and millions and millions of immigrants into this country when we already have tens of millions of people out of work? So now we're going to import more people to compete for jobs that we don't even have here in America anymore, and that means even more people out of work. So how is that going to work out for us?
Yeah, and I think kind of something you're alluding to is, you know, I mean, we're kind of noticing kind of the bastardization of something that was good, which is libertarianism. And it's interesting to use illegal immigration as an example. Like, you know, is it possible that you can abuse or otherwise bastardize libertarianism to the point where it actually supports globalism?
Well, which is what we're doing. Isn't that what we're doing? Isn't that what many of those frameworks of libertarian promulgate? I mean, you know, I sat in the same class with the founder of the Libertarian Party, and I asked him these questions, and he just kind of couldn't answer anymore when I said, well, that's what we have now. How's it working out for us?
But wait a minute, I thought globalism was like this one world government type thing, but libertarians don't like government, but libertarian rationales are being used to give ex post facto justifications for everything the establishment does. Right, because that makes a lot of sense, which, of course, it doesn't. You know, it's kind of a, you know, it's really kind of a monkey wrench in the whole thing. And, you know, me personally, I don't really like seeing, you know, things that are good, at least in a conceptual sense, being bastardized to basically support, you know, the enemy. That's just not
cool. Manufactured dissent, maybe?
Yeah. And, you know, and here's the other thing, you know, especially for the constitutionalists, they should know, at least in the sense of terminology, you'll hear a term called minarchism. And what minarchism is basically like this huge ass umbrella term that basically says anybody who is for limited government is a minarchist, minarchist meaning minimal government for the most part, also known as limited statism. It's also referred to in another way as being in favor of something called the night watchman state. You know, the night watchman state is basically a version of the state where the only responsibilities of the state are to protect your life, liberty, and property. You know, the old Lockean triad. And that's about it. They don't engage in, you know, social welfare distribution schemes. They don't have adventures abroad. They don't do all this horrible status stuff. They just, you know, make sure that the peace is kept, and that's about it. So that was kind of the original conception of the Night Watchman state, and that's what the Republic is supposed to be, is a Night Watchman state. It's, you know, a government, like Randy, you said so many times, a government that's so small that you almost don't notice it's there. That's the Night Watchman state in a nutshell.
Well, you know, and again, you know, a lot of these concepts that these people keep bringing up, they've been tried and proven to fail. Socialism fails. Let's look at Russia. Let's look at every damn socialist country out there. They have all failed miserably. They have failed to the point where the entire concept from the beginning, from its very inception, was a lie upon the people to get them to stand up, to overthrow their previous rulers, to put a very small oligarch into place who then ruled with an iron fist. Can we say Stalin? Can we say Pol Pot? Mao? The list goes on and on. Socialism is proven to be a lie, and it's failed. Let's look at anarchism. You know, we had, you know, if you look at our original government, you know, with the committees of safety, that was technically a form of anarchism there, with the committees of safety. Every town controlled and ruled itself. They all banded together on a county level to decide county matters with their delegates. They banded together on a state level to decide state matter, or a provincial level to, you know, territory level to decide territorial issues, and then they got together on a national level. So there in and of itself, that was a form of anarchism slash libertarianism.
Minarchism, And here's the funny thing, a COS, guys, can technically be kind of like a version on a theme of the DRO. I mean, technically, community safety can resolve disputes in a manner of speaking. So, you know, none of this stuff has to be, you see, that's a common fallacy too, Randy, is that none of these concepts or whatever have to be mutually exclusive, not at all, especially when you look at the properties of each and see where their common values are. You know, it's kind of silly. So you have minarchists on one end saying how great COS are, which is true, and then you have the anarchists saying how great DROs are on the other. It's like, well, technically, in a lot of ways, they're the same thing, in a lot of ways.
Mm-hmm.
You know, but nobody, like, thought that far ahead to actually do a quick compare and contrast. It's kind of
sad. But our committees of safety were not capable of handling all of the issues at hand, so we formed government. And we created the Articles of Confederation. With a federal government so small to be ineffectual, i.e. libertarianism. And how did that work out for us? This country almost destroyed itself within a few short years. So we have historical fact, we have historical backing to look at each one of these types of government and show that they did not work. Then we created a middle ground of them all. We created a republic with a moderate-sized federal government with moderate powers, 17, handed to Congress to help fix some of the issues we had before, like regulating some forms of trade, because trade became a weapon. And, you know, some states were cutting other states off from access to waterways. They were cutting them off with trade. You're not going to pass through here going there. And that almost destroyed our country again. So, that, you know, that libertarian idea didn't quite work either. Then we formed a true republic with a moderate-sized federal government with limited power, state governments holding supreme rule. But the problem that failed is we, the people, got lazy. That was our fault. We let those who were greedy, those who had psychopathic grandeurs or psychopathic delusions of grandeur, take power. We let tyrants come in, and we got lazy, and we said, well, we can't do much about it. We'll get them out in the next election, in the next 4 years, in the next 6 years, in the next 2 years. And soon it got to the point where we couldn't get any of them out because they were all that way. But that wasn't the fault of the republic. That was the fault of the guardians of that republic, we the people. So again, you know, I say that these other forms of government have been tried. And when you're dealing with massive numbers of people, anarchism does not work. It does not work. Again, you know, once you get past your little clan and you start dealing with outside forces or even with forces in within your own clan, how do you regulate anything? How much is my axe worth on any given day? How do I trade 3 eggs for some beef when all that's around is that one cow? You have to begin interacting with other societies outside of yours for trades and for goods and services. Now, how do you regulate that? Anarchism, like I said, are baby libertarians that just haven't grown up yet. Libertarians are idealists who don't realize that a lot of their ideas just don't work. Because as our founding fathers knew, we need a sense of nationalism. Otherwise, our country becomes weak. We've lost our sense of nationalism in this country. We've lost our sense of trade and production in this country. We've opened up free markets. We have had free markets since the Free Trade Act of 1974. How has that worked out for you? Where are your jobs? Oh, your jobs are in China. Your jobs are in the Philippines. Your jobs are in other third world countries being done by slave workers who make pennies a day. So how is that working out for you? We have open borders. We have 20 million illegal aliens here. We have immigrants that are shipped here, paid for by you, the taxpayer, to come here. And the second they step foot here, they're given a huge check for tens of thousands of dollars and put on welfare afterwards. We import our own poverty. And not only are we importing our own poverty, we are importing the destruction of our own culture because we're bringing in people from vastly different cultures who do not wish to assimilate. They just want out of the tyranny that they're under, but they do not wish to assimilate to our culture. Our founding fathers were aware of this. They understood that we needed assimilation to our way of life and our culture in order to remain a free country. We must be independent. In order to be free, you must be independent. You must be able to provide for all the goods and services that your people need in order to be free. Where do you get your oil from? Where do you get your tires from? Last time I checked, damn near every piece of article of clothing I had was made in China or Honduras or the Philippines or somewhere else. And yet we keep importing millions of immigrants every year from vastly different cultures who make us change our culture to accommodate them. And these millions of immigrants come in every year, competing with jobs that no longer exist in America. And right now we have 40 million Americans now living on some form of government assistance. And yet we keep bringing in more and more immigrants. So tell me, how has that open border policy worked for you?
Yeah, it's there are some major problems, obviously, that can't be ignored. And also, you mentioned about China. You know, how did China get to be the big powerhouse it was? Was that through free market activity?
That was actually determined back in 1933 when the Free Trade Act was actually written.
And they cheated again. Oh, amazing
and
how
it was
that pops up.
China, because it had always had a slave culture. All the people in China had always known slavery. They'd always lived under an extreme tyrannical rule that they would make the perfect workers because they would work for very little and they would obey. So it was decided that China, with its vast hordes of workers, would become the next manufacturing and production powerhouse back in 1933. But it took them until 1974 for the American people to fall asleep at the wheel. And forget that we were Americans and that in order to be independent, we must be self-sufficient. Hey, see, we get comments in the chat. You know, we got a comment from Hillary Clinton in the chat room that says, "Welcome to America. Bend over to us or get out." Well, that's right. This is America. This is our country. And if they want to come here to be free, wonderful. One, immigration must serve a purpose. Those immigrating to America must serve a purpose. Two, that Bill of Rights and that Declaration of Independence does not say it's for the world. It was for these United States of America. I know that's a hard concept for some people to understand. You know, I know that... who's that singer, man? She's a Mexican national pop star. What's her name?
Hold on. I think I can picture her in my mind, obviously, but the name is escaping me, too.
Singer that I keep bitching about, the one that got on national TV, she's Mexican, national, she's a Mexican. Christina Aguilera. Christina Aguilera.
Oh, no!
And she said that that Bill of Rights is for everybody of the world. I guess she forgot to read that part where it says the Constitution for these United States of America. So, now let's talk about this, okay? We want to talk about immigration. Let's talk about it. What role do these people have when they come in here? Do we keep continuing to immigrate millions of people into this country every year, whether illegally or legally? Do we continue to keep importing millions of people into this country a year, increasing our poverty level? Because when they get here, there's no jobs because Americans don't even have jobs anymore because we've outsourced all of our jobs due to free markets that all the libertarians and the anarchists want. You've got your free markets. How has that worked out for you? All your jobs are now sitting in China, Guatemala, the Philippines, India. How has that worked out for you? Have you called your credit card company up lately? I have. I can't understand a single word they say to me. How has that worked out for you? So you've got your free trade. You've got your open borders. How has that worked out for you? Or maybe our founding fathers actually knew something. Maybe our founding fathers weren't the idiots that everybody keeps thinking that they were. Maybe we shouldn't try to keep reinventing the wheel. Maybe we should actually take a lesson from them and say, gee, maybe they believed in nationalism for a reason. Because again, unless a country can provide for all of its goods and services that are required of the populace therein, they will be dependent upon somebody somewhere. And once you become dependent upon somebody, you are no longer independent. What part of that do people not understand? Or maybe I'm just a fool for thinking this way. If somebody much more intelligent than me can help me rationalize how this is actually good for us.
Well, don't forget that homesteading principle, like I mentioned earlier. I mean, I would like an answer on that from somebody in the future. Any rebuttals, welcome to that one. But, yeah, it's kind of like, you know, I mean, which is it? And again, it's kind of like it's almost a moot point, too, because what's proven is that the globalists and other assorted bad guys, who various kinds of corporatists, the statists, and others, like open borders to basically use it as a mechanism for balkanizing the local population of whichever country or nation state you're dealing with, and also as a way of deindustrializing those nation states that technically are of the first world. And then, you know, also here's the other thing. You mentioned about Japan earlier, Randy. You know, look at France. The friggin' French. Okay? I can't pronounce the French word that basically is the concept I'm going to describe, but it's known as basically like French secularism or French nationalism, if you want to think of it that way. It starts with a D or something. And, like, the French are, like, very happy, or at least a lot of them, are very happy to be very French. And so if you want to go to France, you speak French, write French, and the rest of it. And, you know, look at their situation. I mean, their own particular conditions, like a famous story was, of course, the Muslim headscarf affair. And if you actually look into the reasons, not just the particular incidents or a series of incidences, but like the background information, the history of that, you know, they've got a huge if I remember correctly, they had like the largest Muslim population in, I think, on the continent.
Mm-hmm.
And so it was like it was a lot, whatever the percentage was, and you guys can go and double check those figures later. The point, though, is that, you know, they have been dealing with, you know, immigration, legal, illegal, and every other version you can think of, if there are other versions, and they are kind of putting their foot down. Even the French government, too. That's the other thing.
You know,
it wasn't just like the private sector. It's the French government is putting their foot down and saying, look, damn it, we're French. And, you know, I find this interesting.
Hang on, let me interject here for something, just so I can reiterate on one point that you made there about having the largest Muslim population. Again, you know, I have no problem with Muslims as long as they want to come to this country and assimilate. You know, France, I was watching a video on France. France has hundreds of square miles within the cities in France that people cannot go to. that the French people cannot go to because they have been taken over by Muslim populations. The police, the paramedics cannot go in there because they are not allowed in there because they get killed going into parts of their own cities. How has that open border worked out for France? People keep talking about open borders. People keep talking about it because it's a feel-good, politically correct thing to do. Well, let's talk about political correctness. Let's look at who made up the word political correctness. Oh, that's right. It was the Marxist socialist who said this is politically correct and this is all you can say. And if you say anything other than what is politically correct, you will be punished.
Wait, where's the tolerance? I'm sorry, that was a libertarian value. I thought we were supposed to be tolerant, right? Oh, wait, damn it.
We're supposed to be tolerant, but we don't have to have this tolerance, but the people that are coming in don't have to be tolerant to our way of life here. They come in, they try to take over. Let's look at all these people. You know, we got La Raza down in, you know, the southwestern states saying, give us free money, give us free homes, give us free food, give us free doctors, or we will continue to kill more police on the border. These are the people I want coming into my country? We've got the brown berets who are calling for open genocide upon all Americans, all white Americans. These are the people that I want coming into my country? Again, I say to hell with the open borders people. Come to America if you want. Come to America because you want to be an American. Because you want to engage in our freedom and you want to interact with your public. You want to become free, not to enforce your will upon us. I want to reiterate that Bill of Rights that everybody keeps thinking was written for the world is part of a document that says this, that says the Constitution for these United States of America. And our founding fathers were nationalists. They were nationalists. They were pro-Americans, pro-Americans. They were America firsters. Remember that.
Yeah, well, I mean, me personally, I can't wait till libertarians of any kind, the mainline libertarians, ones that are more anarchical, and various other ones. I can't wait till libertarians in general in these United States, you know, see through the fog of...
I love doing those shows, Brad. I love doing those shows, Brad. I did, man. That was the very first time I was ever on air. You know, if anybody ever gets a chance, go to www.seeingthroughthefog.com. You're going to find archives and links there for some of the very first broadcasts I ever did with a friend of mine in Canada. Man, we got into some shit there. I had some of the most intellectual discussions I've ever had in my life, and we just hammered through all the bullshit on a very intellectual level. And we dispersed the entire fog of illusion of all of these arguments and brought it down to a very logical level. I understand, the pure theoretical ideas of these things. Yes, it would be great if we could all be free, one big happy global family, and we all loved one another, and we all took care of one another, and life was just peachy, keen, and dandy. That's not a reality, people. That is not a reality, though. Take off the rose-colored glasses, tap your heels 3 times because you're not in Kansas anymore. Come on back to reality now, people. We live in a dangerous world where there will always be people who dislike us just because we are free. There will be people that dislike us because of our color of our skins. There will be people that dislike us because we are Americans. Even within our own country, you have the Black Panthers calling for race war. Now, the majority of the Black Panthers are, oh God, they're Muslims. And it's funny because these Muslims, these Black Americans have congregated, now, not just Black Americans, Black people throughout the world, they've swarmed to this religion that is a religion of their initial slave masters. They blame us, the Americans, for their slavery. No. No, no. No, no. It was the Arabs that enslaved you. and it was your own people that sold you into slavery initially to those Arabs. Don't blame me for that. I had nothing to do with it. But everybody wants race wars. So again, I preach America first. I preach intolerance for those who are intolerant to my freedoms. I preach intolerance to those who want to change my republic. I am understanding the ideas of a solid, set-in-stone law like the Constitution that allow all people to live their own way and not force others to live one way or the other. I do. I do. You're not understanding the spirit of in which I was written. You haven't read enough. Our founding fathers were nationalists. They were America firsters. They were pro-America. They did not let in massive flooding immigration from vastly diverse cultures. Look what our founding fathers said about the Muslims. But you haven't read that far, have you? Look what our founding fathers said about massive influx, massive flooding from vastly divergent cultures. But we haven't read that far, have we? And you know, and I don't even care about that. I say if a Muslim wants to come to America and he wants to assimilate and become an American and live free and not enforce his will upon me, welcome aboard. But be productive to my to this country. And no, I do not promote bringing in millions every year when we have when we have 40 million adult Americans living, having to live off of government checks because there's no jobs. What part of that is not reaching through anybody's common sense? There are no jobs in America for Americans as it is. So why would we keep bringing in millions more people to compete for the jobs that are left when there's already 40 million of us without jobs? What part of that do you not get for all those people out there who are screaming for open borders and free trade? And again, I ask you, how have these open borders worked out for you? How has this free market economy worked out for you? When's the last time anybody had a job at Dell?
Well, obviously, it's not free market. I mean, they lie. The establishment puts together stuff like NAFTA and claims it's free trade, and it's not. It's an oligarchical piece of crap is what it is, and they play games with, I mean, again, going back to 1984, I mean, there was a term called newspeak, all right, so one of their newspeak terms is claiming it's free trade, and it's like totally not. I mean, it's all got government protections and privileges and the rest of it, and don't believe me, guys, double check.
No,
and then they blame the free market, and then they blame the free market, they blame capitalism for all this horrible stuff that's going on, when these guys cheat, they're corporatists, they want the coercive power of the state to protect them, and that's kind of a problem. And then worse on top of that, you have other libertarians who kind of sanction some of that kind of activity because they can't see through the fog, like, at all, and it's kind of a problem. And it's weird, too, because some of those libertarians who can't see through the fog understand, like, the left-right paradigm, so it's like they're kind of like in a weird in-between place. And then there are other libertarians who don't like those guys because they kind of do see through the fog and understand all the cheating and stuff like that, and they understand that, you know, there's a reason why it's now referred to as the remnants of the free market. You know, it still exists, but it's remnants.
We have a question from the chat room. I hate to interrupt you, but I want to get this done real quick because I'm already a little bit over my time, but I want to answer this one because it's... So this is from Hillary Clinton again in the chat room. So you're saying that they have to comply with your values? No, they don't have to comply with my values. My values are much different than other people's out there. How I raise my family is not going to be the way that you raise your family. But they must respect my freedoms. They must respect that this is a republic and that this is our country and our culture. Yes, they must respect that. They must assimilate to our way of life. Even Roosevelt said that. Assimilate or get out. Do not come here thinking to change our culture and our country to fit you. You come here because you want to be free. Part of that freedom is allowing us to be free in our own country, allowing me to say Merry Christmas if I choose to, allowing me to worship or not to worship whichever God I choose to, allowing me to say whatever the hell I want to another individual without you interfering in what I say. My right to assemble and walk the streets of my city or my county or my state or my country at any time without a horde of immigrants taking control of those of mile-long city blocks and saying, you're not allowed here anymore. We've taken over. Look to Europe for your free trade agreement, for your open border, and see how it's worked out. And already in the U.S., there have been numerous documents that have been written that said, in 20 years, America will no longer be American. So how have your open border policies worked out for you? You know, I get all these people, I get all these people constantly telling me that open borders, well, I'm asking them and nobody ever tells me. How have they worked out so far for you? They keep trying to, they keep coming back with this all Alinsky tactics of diverting the conversation or making me the bad guy by saying, so you want everybody to comply with your values? No. I want them to come to America because they want to be free. But I don't want an overflooding of immigration into my country to compete with American jobs when Americans don't even have jobs. So instead of trying your Saul Alinsky tactics on me, why don't you take a close look at the issue at hand and ask yourself, we've already got this, and how has it worked out for us? We've got diverging cultures in this country that have taken over parts of cities. We've got Muslims that are in here in Ohio with training camps that are practicing in full battle rattle with fully automatic assault weapons. And yet I'm being told that if more than two or three or four of us gather together and we train with weapons, that's illegal. We're the militia. We're mandated in both the U.S. Constitution and the state constitutions, all 50 of them. They can come to this country and do what they want, but we can't even do it in our country because it's racist. Because we're intolerant. Worship as you please, but do not force it upon me. I care not if while man worships one god or 100 gods, it breaks not my leg nor harms my fields. What does break my legs and harms my fields, though, is when they come to this country, though, and try to convert it to something other than the republic in which it was. Yes, we do have open borders. Yes, we do. If we didn't, we wouldn't have 20 million migrant workers in this country. We wouldn't have a million immigrants being shipped into this country every year. We have a very open border policy. You're just too narrow-minded to look and see it. You haven't done your research and checked your facts. I've been doing this for 25 years. I have met very few people that can actually teach me something that I don't already know as far as these issues are concerned. I have read over 10,000 books dealing with subjects and issues like this. I have read the very laws drafted in the 1800s and the very documents that were drafted in the 1800s talking about how they would destroy America through an open border policy, through the deindustrialization of our country and shipping off our industry and our manufacturing to other nations. You know, before the Free Trade Agreement Act, if we sold manufacturing or dying technology to other countries, that was treason. And it was that way even our founding fathers' days. Why? Because we understood that in order to be an independent nation, we must be independent. We must be self-sufficient and able to take care of our own needs. Because the second that we became needful to another country to supply us for the goods and services that we needed, we would become dependent upon them. And once you become dependent, you lose your independence. I'm assuming that Yeah Right was to the reference of the number of books that I've read. I have. I've read more books than probably anybody I've ever met in my life. I've read the books that you refuse to read. I've read Brzezinski's books. Between Two Ages. I've read all of Carol Quigley's writings, like Tragedy and Hope, The Anglo-American Establishment. I've read Charles Galton Darwin's books. The most important book I read by him was The Next Million Years, that laid out the plan for these globalists very succinctly, which went hand in hand with Carol Quigley's Tragedy and Hope and The Anglo-American Establishment. I've read the writings of Lord Cecil Rhodes, Lord Rothschild, and Lord Milner when they created the Round Table Societies and then created the Fabian, or then created the Royal Institute of International Affairs, and then created the Fabian Society, and then created the League of Nations, and then created the UN, and all these other think tanks like the Club of Rome and all these other groups out there. I've read all of their books. I've read all of their writings. What have I done to make America self-sufficient? Well, that's a bad question to ask Amici, because I got all kinds of answers for you. I've done patriotic duty. I have done my patriotic duty. I have engaged upon the law at the age of 17 in the state of Nevada. I joined my first militia. The rest of my family, throughout our history, has always been in the military, most of us special forces. Me, I read the Constitution. I realized that most of our military is actually in violation of that Constitution. And I had a choice. I chose to continue to go to school. I went to UNLV. I went to the University of Washington. I joined my first militia at 17. I helped form over 100 militias between the ages of 18 and 25. I have promoted and done speaking engagements in front of hundreds of people over the last 20 years, 25 years now. I've hosted this radio broadcast for the last 5 years discussing everything from our Constitution to its founding fathers and everything else in between. I have taught people that independence is the way that America was meant to be, self-reliance upon each other. Shall I continue on?
Hey, Randy, hey, don't let Hillary Clinton get you down, man. She's a globalist. and she also said that, you know, the State Department.
You said Hillary Clinton says she buys American. Check the label on your shirt.
Wait. I thought Hillary Clinton said that the State Department was losing the info war. Oh, man. But yeah, and here's the funny thing, you know, to the dude in the chat room who is so very similarly titled to the Osu Inzimus, state secretary or whatever her current, you know, fake job is that dude, just look at the security partnership and what was it called? It was the SPP, Security, Prosperity and Partnership, I believe it was called, which was a series of, international agreements between Canada, the United States, and Mexico to basically erase the borders and form a version of the European Union known as the North American Union. Like, provably, Judicial Watch got the documents for it, as well as a bunch of other people. So, and the funny thing is that when the SPP stuff broke a couple years ago, and then the ball started rolling on, that was actually Bush Jr., guys. It was actually Bush Jr., Vicente Fox, and Paul Martin. And I find it funny that, you know, you bring up about, like, open borders or whatever, and, like, that is, like, the biggest open border thing ever. You know, it makes, you know, NAFTA and GATT look, you know, same by comparison. And what was funny, too, is that the SPP, when that was being broken, the Canadians of the three were the really big getting on the horn about that. In fact, I actually remember there's this one individual who mentioned that, you know, he is a, you know, he's like a fervent Canadian nationalist because he opposes globalism. And that the SPP was all about eroding Canada's sovereignty, as well as the sovereignty of here in Mexico, obviously. But so that's kind of interesting, is the SPP. So, you know, do a search for the Security, Prosperity, and Partnership documents. Hell, there's even a Wikipedia page on it. So if you haven't done, like, flight work with anything involving the borders, look for the SPP. That's easy proof without even getting into much of anything else. And then, of course, if you want to go on the more theoretical side of it, look, you know, homesteading principle, and then sit down and just think about it. instead of typing stuff that you haven't really thought of. I'm just saying, dude. No hard feelings, but you got to play catch up. You know, this stuff was revealed like over 5 years ago, approximately. You know, it's 2012. This is like old news now. I mean, it's been well known that the bad guys have been trying to erode the sovereignty of all three countries here just in North America. I mean, come on. I mean, you know, I mean, look, if the let's put it this way. If the Canadians are getting upset about it, yeah, there's a border problem. I'm just saying. You know, it's really not that hard to figure out. Just saying, dude. But yeah, it's and again, it's pretty sad. You know, it's kind of funny. You know, this a lot of folks who understand that, you know, the military industrial complex is bad, or that understand that welfare is bad, or any of these other things, which are bad things, that's all based on cheating and the course of power of the state, hurting people, whatever the case is, then they go and support something that the bad guys are doing. It's like, why? It hurts people. It's whether you're looking at it economically or in terms of, like, physical security, like you were mentioning, Randy, earlier about the different towns with certain enclaves there, or you want to look at it socially, i.e. balkanizing different segments of people, which is not good for, you know, peace and harmony or whatever, and tolerance. That's actually anti-tolerant, is deliberately creating a situation where you're going to have different kinds of people being balkanized. You know, that's not cool. You know, how libertarian is that? Not really. You see, that's the funny thing, is that the true libertarian position when it comes to stuff like that, if anyone was being honest, but of course you would actually have to be doing this for a while and be internally consistent, which is always a problem, is that you look at, like, the liberty of association. Well, there's also the reciprocal aspect of that. It's also the liberty of not associating with someone. So if you choose to not want to be around other folks, dude, cool. If you want to go shut yourself up and be a recluse, it's your life. I mean, that's really the libertarian, the real libertarian attitude. Dude, it's your life. Make it as you will. Laissez-faire means let it be. And that's kind of the problem, is that it's just like,
oh, you know, let's look at who brought us laissez-faire. It was the elite setting up the manufacturing plants where they forced little boys and little girls as young as 5 and 6 years old to work 12, 16-hour days. People had to sleep in the factory itself because they had to work there, and they were not allowed to live outside of that factory. You know, it was another way of slave labor and indentureship that we have exported to China and Guatemala and the Philippines and all these other countries to make Martha Stewart rich.
Well, again, I mean, that's all cheating corporate behavior anyway. I mean, again, if I'm trading with my neighbor or whatever, I mean, have we harmed anyone? And that's kind of a good, and I'm glad you brought that up, Randy, is that look at, like, any sort of economic activity. If people are trading, they're bartering, they're using money, whatever the case is, you know, when they engage in economic activity, is there a byproduct whereby there is some sort of harm coming to anyone, especially a third party? For example, very brief example.
Sleepy, before we get into this, man, it's 11:30.
Oh, damn, sorry.
I've got training to do. I've learned a whole new industry. You know, sales is my gig. It's what I do. I love to, you know, deal with American small mom-and-pop businesses and help them excel and become more productive. So I found a company that believes in that same principle and philosophy, and I'm beginning a new job with them. And but unfortunately, it's in a completely new industry, man, and I'm just kind of wiped out and burned out. But it is 11:35, everybody. We are 35 minutes past our end time, and I was actually thinking about cutting this show short tonight. See what happens when I get riled up? When I start talking about America First, and I got people telling me, you know, trying to tell me things that they just really haven't researched that much, and open borders and free markets, and I just keep asking them, that's what we have now. How's it working out for you? You know, so, Sleepy, close us out here, man. What do you got to say in closing? And then I got a couple of things to say in closing, and then we're just going to close out.
Well, my extremely fast first part of my closing is that we should probably do this again sometime, because there's also a lot more to get into, because this is a very vast topic, obvious, or subject matter, obviously. And quick second part is that, like, look, I mean, whenever you look into political philosophy, you know, you're always going to come across minefields. You're always going to come across contradictions and stuff. And what should happen, kind of with the real free market does, not the corporate bad stuff, but when you engage in real good economic behavior where you don't harm anybody when you trade, is that it's always supposed to be self-correcting. So same thing here when you're dealing with political philosophy or whatever, especially libertarianism and anarchism, it's got to be internally consistent. If it's not internally consistent, it is your duty, if you are going to be intellectually honest and logical and rational, to ask questions. If something doesn't make sense to you guys, if you run up against somebody who's part of the LP or who claims he's a market anarchist or whatever version it happens to be this week, ask questions. That is the best thing you can do. Ask questions. Get them to clarify their position. If they can prove something, cool. You at least understand them. You don't have to agree with it. You at least understand them, and at least it's clarified. And if you can get that far ahead, if you can get to that point, you will be light years ahead of other folks where they just bicker with each other and get nowhere. And again, Randy, thank you for having me on. I appreciate it.
I appreciate you coming on too, Sleepy. I have enjoyed this conversation, man. It kind of reminded me of the old days with Brad and stuff.
Yeah, and I will say, this publicly too. You know, I've asked on like previous podcasts, the stuff I do, whatever, about, you know, I'll ask like newer guests, like, how are you awakened? And I think from now on, what I'm going to do is, I like seeing through the fog better, because, you know, when we say awaken, there's these issues of like, how shall we say, like, oh, I'm super special or whatever because I saw some random documentary or whatever the case is. But when you say see through the fog, that means that it's about your perception altering and recognizing illusion and getting past it. Again, it's a journey, not the destination kind of distinction. So I kind of like seeing through the fog a lot better of trying to more accurately describe that phenomenon of that change, that paradigm shift.
Oh, you know, you're right, and that's why we call this Saint to the Fog. You know, I hate all this jargon, this patriot lingo that we have, you know, the movement, the cause, all these slogans that we have. And, you know, let's remember what Stalin said. We will overthrow the people. We will indoctrinate the people by the use of slogans and chants. And the Fed. That's all I got to say. You know, so I hope I did my job tonight, people. I hope that I stimulated your gray matter. I hope I made you think. I hope I opened your eyes a little bit and helped you to see a little bit more through that fog that that has been enveloping us more and more over the last 150 years since the late 1850s, when the true plan to corrupt and overthrow our government and the people within and to bring down our nation as a whole and bring us into a big global government system first initiated itself with three individuals, Lord Cecil Rhodes, Lord Rothschild, and Lord Milner. That was sort of in the 1850s. You know, I called my show, that very first show, Seeing Through the Fog, because that's what we've all been done. And even the vast majority of the patriots today in America are still trapped within that web of fog that just envelops us and surrounds us. And we can't see past it. You know, but just like everybody else out there, you know, each one of us has to do our part every day, little bit by little bit each day. You know, if I could, you know, if it only took one person to free this country, I would have done it 25 years ago. But unfortunately, we're still not free today. Which means that it's going to take a hell of a lot more than just me, or Sleepy, or any of you in this room, or listening on this broadcast today. We need to get past all the fog, including the patriot mythology and propaganda that's going around. And it all starts with individual action out there. Remember, we are individuals. Our freedoms are based upon an individual level. Now, tomorrow, Wednesday, at 4 p.m. at Truth Finders Network, which is our parent station, there's going to be another weekly round table there where people get together and they discuss ideas and solutions. It starts at 4 p.m. Eastern Standard Time or Eastern Time. Well, I don't know whether we're on Eastern Time, Eastern Standard, or Eastern Daylight Time, to be honest with you. But it starts at 4 p.m. Eastern Time at www.truthfindersnetwork.com. There's been some great roundtables that have gone on there. Some genius has actually leaked out of some people, which is a good thing. Everybody's invited. Everybody's welcome. If you've got some ideas, if you've got some comments, if you've got something you're working on that we can help implement in other areas of this country, if you had success doing anything, by all means, step up to the plate, jump in. You know, I know a lot of people, they like to listen, they like to hear stuff, man, but, you know, this country was based upon each one of us being a leader ourselves. Each one of us is our own leader. Whether you're the head of your family, the head of your community, a leader within your community, whatever it is, we're all meant to be leaders. So let's step up to the plate. Let's actually come up with some solutions and some ideas. Whatever it is you're working on, if it's working in your area, share it with others. Tell others. Let's help implement other things in other areas. We can all build upon each other's successes. So with that being said, I will see everybody there tomorrow at 4 p.m. I believe I'll see everybody there at 4 p.m. I think I'm going to be there at 4 p.m. I'll be able to stay for a little while. I've got things to do again, as always, starting a new job, new career, and all that other good stuff. So I've got homework to do. But other than that, I'm going to try and step in for a little bit if I can, at least throw in my two cents on some, see if I can stimulate some gray matter there. Maybe be a little bit of a muse for people out there. Maybe give you an idea that might work in your area. So with that being said, everybody, Resistance to Tyranny. There's a blurb for it over the right-hand side of our chat room at www.youhavetreadonme.com. This is the most important book I think that has been written in the last 100 years. You know, I used to have a top 10 list of books to read, the most important books that I think every American should read. I went off some of those books earlier. You know, Bernays' Propaganda, Carol Quigley's Tragedy and Hope and Between Two Ages. Oh, I'm sorry, Tragedy and Hope and the Anglo-American Establishment, Brzezinski's Between Two Ages, Charles Galton Darwin's The Next Million Years, Lord Bertrand Russell's The Science of Impact on Society, H.G. Wells' Open Conspiracy. And most of these books are not those fiction books that you like to read, and most of them are dry, but they tell you exactly what was planned and what's coming down the pike and why. This book, Resistance to Tyranny, made the top 11 book list. I have not added a book to that list in over 20 years, except this book. This is truly the most important book I've written, I think, that has been written in the last 100 years. And it's not just for Americans or anybody. This is for any people. Whether you're living in a state of tyranny now, or you live in a country where tyranny might raise its ugly head, which is every country in the world, because there was not a single country that tyranny has not risen up in or come to. And if tyranny ever does come to a free people, what will you do if you have not thought about it beforehand? So right now the book is $17.95. It sells for, I believe, for $19.95 over at eBay. eBay does not need your money. I could use your help supporting this station. I've been doing this for 5 years on my own dime, my own everything. And I could use your help with it now. I've never asked for anything. I've never asked for donations or anything. But I will promote this book. And I've never sold anything on this website either, except for this one book recently, because I believe this book is that important. So do me a favor, everybody that has read this book, that has gotten a copy of this book, said it is one of the most amazing books I've ever read, and this is coming from some great minds out there, Gary Hunt, Smiter, Tomahawk, lots and lots of people have read this book already. There's only two places you can get it from, right here or at eBay. Help you get it from me. Help support another patriot out there. Everybody that buys a copy of this book here for the next 2 weeks, we'll get an actual signed copy of the book with a little message in it from Joe Martino, and it is such an interesting little message. It's short, but it is deep, very deep. So all you got to do is click that link right there. It'll take you, click the little Resistance to Tyranny banner on the page, or you can jump up to the top of the website where it says Resistance to Tyranny. Click that link up there. It'll take you to the page, page where I'm telling about the book, and there's a PayPal button there. If you don't like using PayPal or credit cards, hit me up with an email, randymack@uoftreadonme, and I'll tell you how you can order the book using cash or money order. I've got a new shipment of books coming in. It'll be here shortly. There was a short slight delay on them. They didn't like my paperwork, so I had to redo my paperwork. So a little bit of a delay there, the publisher. So I had a little bit of a delay, but got new books coming in now, so everything is hunky-dory again. They'll be here, and they'll be here very shortly, so you'll be getting your book very shortly. So, again, try and help me out here. If you like this broadcast, I'm not asking you for money. I will offer, though, to sell you a book that I truly believe will be of great benefit to you. Not looking for donations here, not looking for a handout, but I am looking for you to help support me if you can. That book is an incredible way to do that. Help yourself, help me at the same time. So with that being said, everybody, be safe, be free, and I will see you guys again tomorrow. For those that go on to truthfindersnetwork.com, I'll see you there tomorrow for a little bit. Sleepy Salsa has a broadcast coming up this Saturday at 8 p.m. Eastern Time. I believe it's on survivalism, Sleepy?
Yes, it is. The banner's up. Yep, and the banner's up on the blog, so go to thelastbeststeel.wordpress.com and on the right-hand side where it says categories, click the Last Bastille podcast, and it should be the most recent one. But yes, the banner's up.
So we're going to be doing the next broadcast will be this Sunday, or this Saturday, sorry, this Saturday at 8 p.m. Eastern Time. Remember that. Sleepy comes on an hour before I do on Saturdays. 8 p.m. Eastern Time, I'll be discussing survivalism. And I will be back on next Sunday doing something. I forgot what. Those are always interesting, man. I've got too much on my mind right now. But I'll be having another great show again, as always. So I'll see you guys then. Next Saturday, or tomorrow, Saturday, Sunday, and next Tuesday. Sunday and Tuesday are going to be 9 p.m. Eastern time for me. We'll also have another couple of hosts coming on here very shortly, which is going to be the Voice of Truth. He's going to be doing a What's Going On in America 101 type thing. And Fox is going to be coming back on again doing the Armory. Fox is also going to be a guest coming up here on Sleepy, not this Saturday, but the following Saturday, I believe, with Firearms Basics. And Fox is well-versed to speak on that subject. He used to work on firearms. He was, he worked in a gun shop, worked on firearms and all the other good stuff, and he was trained to do this stuff, so that should be a very interesting show as well. So we'll see everybody then. Good night, be safe, be free, everyone. Do something.
Hey, the British are coming! The British are coming!
Now the ride of Paul Revere said the name.
Hey, the British are coming! Hey, the British are coming!